Kia ora, good morning, morena, welcome to Fringe Radio. It's day 14. The Fringe started exactly 2 weeks ago today, and this is Fringe Radio. We're here from 9 till 12 every day, doing reviews and previews and interviews with artists. And today, we've got two artists coming in. Just get myself organized with the right place. We have got Morgana O'Reilly, who's coming to talk about her show, Stories About My Body, which is on tonight, 8:30 p.m. at 116. And I think that's going to be by phone. Morgana's going to be on the way up from Auckland, and so she'll be driving and talking at the same time, and be on speakerphone, and hopefully that will work all right. We won't have too much problem with reception. And then we've also got, at some point this morning, when he can... He's doing some film shooting down in Wellington. Alan McElroy, whose show Mistaken Identity opens at 6 p.m. tonight, so he's cutting it fine to get to Whangarei, but that's he's got a gig, so he's got to do it. And unfortunately his show, I remembered now, his show Mistaken Identity has been cancelled tonight at 6 o'clock. He's just doing one show tomorrow at 4 p.m. at Fringe After Dark. Unfortunately, work has made it impossible for him to get here today. So we're going to do a phone interview this morning, and then he'll be up in Whangarei tomorrow. Okay, so just quick overview of what's happening today. Friday the 14th of October, there's the Fringe Youth Art Workshop starting at 10 a.m. And that is at the Quarry Arts Centre. Fringe for Kids Holiday Workshop starts in an hour. The description goes like this: we're all super beings in different ways. Some are super listeners, super sharers, or super energetic. No shit. This workshop is a chance to discover your super form through paints and clay with any features you can imagine while we talk about what makes us who we are. Oh, that sounds cool. Talking about who we are while making stuff. It's got to be a win, especially for the energetic ones. Recommended for ages 8 to 14 with Canberra-based guest facilitator Lumiel Riccardi. And if you want to look at the full program and book, you can go to quarryarts.org/fringe. And Jared Taylor is the contact there for any inquiries. We had Jared in earlier talking about the Creative Tech Northland workshop, which happened earlier in the week. Okay, so that's at 10. The Imaginarium is at 3:33 p.m. as always. Don't be late. And then 5:30 p.m. Barrier Ninja has its final show, I think. Yes, I'm right. So the final show of Barrier Ninja is at 5:30 p.m. and that's at 116. It's a great show. If you've never seen Verbatim Theatre before, it's quite a powerful way to put marginalised voices and voices we don't often hear on stage. People whose experiences in the health system, both professionals and patients, or tangata whai ora. And also at 5:30 p.m. Ready Set are playing, and I think they've played a couple of times. This is their second gig today at 5:30. They played yesterday, today and tomorrow. They are playing today and tomorrow. They played yesterday. It's free. It's a 45 minute gig. It's at Whangarei Girls High Theatre, 5:30 p.m. 6 p.m. Oh, so Alan's Mistaken Identity show has been cancelled, so that won't be happening. Then at 6:30 p.m. The Awkward Indian Guy Act, which I'm having a conversation with Advait tomorrow, and he's the comedian. Awkward by neurology, Indian by ethnicity, Guy by anatomy. He's trying to fit into New Zealand as an autistic South Asian man. This act has the outside view for inside jokes. So it's great great that someone's who's upfront about autism. And some of the people with autism that I've met have got an incredible memory for jokes. So I'll be looking forward to talking to him tomorrow on the show and asking him if that's one of the advantages of autism, is that you've got a prodigious memory for facts. And then at 7 p.m., Man Lessons, the live show, has its second performance here at 116. I saw that last night, and I've been up since 4 o'clock in the morning writing a review. So I'll need another coffee quite soon. Then at 7:30 p.m., Bury Me Happy is Brendan Lovegrove's comedy show. I think he's just got one. I think it's just a one-off. Yep, it's a one-off. That's at Fringe After Dark. And if you haven't seen him before, terrifyingly funny, I think, is a good description of him. He may be the master of insult comedy. He and Alexander Sparrow, who also performed earlier this week. At 8 p.m., Maggie Cocco's Science for Sociopaths is being performed again for the second time at the Octagon Theatre, a lovely intimate venue for that sort of performance. It's at 8 p.m., $30 or pay what you can. 8:30 p.m., Morgana O'Reilly is here with Stories About My Body. I saw that when she performed it at Q, and it's a very funny, enjoyable, powerful, actually, very personal show, a bit like Man Lessons. It's a personal journey, and it's in your face, literally, and it makes no apology for that. The description says, there will be nudity, and you will love it. So if you don't get the picture, then don't come. At 9 p.m., we have Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers, comedians. Their show is called All Your Money Back. There's a clip of Ray O'Leary. I've seen it several times. It keeps coming up on Facebook, where he's talking in his very deadpan, laconic, almost sort of willfully dumb kind of voice about, you know, people say it's save the environment by peeing in the shower, but he ends up taking three or four showers a day. It's quite amusing, sort of, I don't know what kind of humor that is, but it's definitely very deadpan and dry. So if you like that, 9 p.m. at the Fringe After Dark Club, and then at 10 p.m., the Buskers on the Road Comedy Cabaret happens again here at 116. They came into the studio yesterday and we had a good chat. I might replay that again today because I don't have a huge number of guests today, or some might materialize, you never know. It's all a bit last minute. And yeah, Buskers on the Road is here at 116, $20 or $15, 1.5 hour show. There will be knife juggling, there will be spinning plates on sticks, and humor and banter and a high energy show. All right, so to kick off, I'm going to play the interview I did yesterday with Adam Rowe and Ben Sarton, who are the performers from Man Lessons, the live show. Spoke to them for about half an hour, so I'm going to play that in its entirety in the hope that it will inspire you to come and see their show. There are still tickets available, and it's a powerful journey. It's a story that needs to be heard, so hopefully, here goes. Ideas about what the show's about, and I'm pleased to welcome Adam, is it Rohe? Is that the correct pronunciation?
Rohe.
Oh,
is
Rohe.
The Americanized. Yeah.
Oh, Rohe.
Yeah.
Okay, I was wondering if it's the Maori Rohe.
Yes, so do most folks. It's German. Rohe, I think is how you said it in German, but yeah, no, we immigrated to the States like a couple generations back, and that pronunciation took over.
I see. So, but it's spelt the same as the Maori word,
yep.
Rohe, isn't it? Which, okay. And Ben Sarton is also here. And Ben is part of the show. You're actually part of them. You're on stage with Adam?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Cool.
I'm filming and I have a few lines.
I see. So you're actually filming during the show?
Yeah.
Ah. And is that in order to gather material for the documentary that you're making?
Yeah, that's part of it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I understand from your description, this has been in production for 6 years. Is that right?
Yeah, it must be close to seven.
I think it's seven now. Yeah.
Right.
It was October. So yeah, it would be seven.
So how did you two sort of end up working together or doing this project together?
I used to work in a rock climbing room in Taranaki, and Adam used to come in climbing, and so we ended up just being climbing buddies for a bit.
Mm. Where was this? Which town?
This was in New Plymouth.
Uh-huh, right. So you're both from New Plymouth?
I grew up in Tukurangi, which is just north of New Plymouth.
Uh-huh. Mm,
I'm not. I was born in the States, and then I grew up in the States in Cambodia, and then Stratford in Taranaki from when I was 11. Yeah.
So wait, the States, and then Cambodia, and then Taranaki. How did that little journey happen?
My parents and their social conscience.
Oh, what kind of work were they doing?
They're both medical professionals. They were working as physios, and my mum's a midwife as well.
Right.
They had both lived overseas previously, my dad with his first family and my mum as a child.
Right.
And they just wanted to get us kids out of the States before we got totally brainwashed into only one way of being.
Right.
Yeah,
wow.
So Cambodia was the answer.
And how long did you spend in Cambodia?
2.5 years.
Right. What's it like?
Different now than then. Then was pretty bleak, hot and dusty, and everyone had some sort of horror story and disability to prove it.
From the wars.
Yeah.
Right.
So the Vietnam War was in the early 70s, and a lot of that was fought in Cambodia, over the border. And then there was the Khmer Rouge after that, which is just kind of like big, genocidal.
Yeah.
situation.
Yeah, nightmare. Yeah.
Yeah. So they were pretty fucked, and there weren't that many. Oh, can I swear on your show?
You're welcome to swear. We encourage swearing on this.
Good,
luckily, we don't have any advertisers to upset, so you can say what the fuck you like.
Okay, good. Yeah, no, they were fucked. And there was, like, not that many white folks or aid organizations in yet. And still kind of 2 landmines going off a day at that time, and there were no other Barang or Pakeha kids in the city that we grew up in.
Really?
Yeah.
None. So did you learn... How long... So you were there 2.5 years. Was that long enough to learn the language or...?
Yeah, we had it in a couple of months, my sister and I. Just like small children's brains are quite very porous. Yes. Yeah.
Right. So how old were you again at that stage?
8.
Right. Okay. So from Cambodia, they came to New Zealand?
Yeah.
Oh, and they've settled here, I guess you're...
As settled as my family get.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're both, what, doctors? Oh, so your mum's a midwife.
And dad's a physio. Well, dad's retired, but was a physio.
Oh, yeah. So they settled in Taranaki.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And that's how you bumped into Ben at the climbing wall in New Plymouth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I guess you must have become friends then. You kind of got to know each other and...
Yeah, we hung out a couple of times and then we sort of went our separate ways, as people do.
Yeah.
I was travelling around a bit and I didn't even really know what you were up to. Theatre.
Studying
theatre.
Oh. Yeah. Did you study theatre, Adam?
Yeah, for 4 years. I was in Palmerston North for a year and then Auckland for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
You were, but I remember Ben because Ben had been cool in the rock wall and taught me how to ride a unicycle, and then I just kind of followed Ben on the socials.
Right.
Yeah, and I'd taken off to a few different disaster countries to do documentary filmmaking.
Uh-huh.
I went to Nepal after the earthquakes in 2016.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And Fiji after Cyclone Winston. And a few of those other places. I'd like started to dig into documentary making.
Uh-huh.
And I think those sort the first couple of like just like really short docos that I made, just New Zealand based ones, I think was what got Adam interested in what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Yeah, and then it was 2015, I came out as trans, and I was in the business of storytelling and thought it should be a doco, whatever happens next.
Right.
And I still thought Ben was really cool, and I knew that he was making... Oh, sorry, they were making docos.
Mm.
And, yeah, so I called them up and was like, do you want to do something?
Great. So this is quite a... Did the other documentaries get made, Ben, like the Nepal and the Fiji ones?
Yeah, I was working for an NGO, and they were hiring me as a content creator, so I would take photographs and make really short, like, sort of promotional documentary-style content for them. So I made a lot of stuff for them.
I see. Wasn't like a feature-length documentary.
None of that. Oh, okay. So like what's social media things.
Right. What was the NGO, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, fine, yeah, no problem.
They went all toxic and yuck.
Okay.
And I don't want them to have any promotion.
Okay, fine, fair enough. So what's your background in terms of, are you self-taught as a documentary maker?
Yeah, mainly. Yeah, I just picked up a camera when I was doing a lot of unicycling, thought it was cool, and then just kept making movies.
So were you just a unicyclist, or were you a street performer, or like, what was the context of the unicycling?
I was like a... not street performing, not clowning. It was like competitive trials, unicycling and downhill and a few other things. I competed in the World Champs.
There is the thing called competitive downhill unicycling.
Yeah, that's exactly what you imagine, like downhill tracks, but on unicycles.
Uh-huh.
And then trials like obstacle hopping over picnic tables.
So quite technically difficult.
Yeah.
And are you still a unicyclist?
Nah, I sold my unicycles. I kept hurting myself.
Oh, yeah. Is the injury thing quite a thing with unicycles? Is it quite likely to get injured? It looks quite unstable.
Not particularly, but when you just like... With anything, if you start to push further and further and harder and you get out to the like extremes of what your body can handle, then you're going to start hurting yourself. So same with skateboarding or motorcycling or whatever it is that you choose to do activity-wise, you end up... If you push hard enough, you start hurting yourself. So.
Okay, so this documentary, is there a kind of end point with this? Do you foresee there'll be a time when it's completed, or how do you sort of see that?
Yeah, there's three interviews left to do, and then it's shot.
Wow.
It's all shot. I mean, apart from the stuff we're doing, I'm shooting on stage, and that's partly for the documentary and just partly for ourselves to like have that record, because it's always nice to have a record of your shows that you do.
Yeah.
Also,
it demonstrates, having Ben and the camera on stage really demonstrate the role that having the camera in my life has played. So it's been like a quite consistent like point of reflection and processing for me for the last 7 years. So yeah, we're kind of demonstrating that as well by having Ben in the camera on stage.
And Ben's giving you access to the footage that's shot. Like, are you sort of reviewing it together and doing that as a sort of partnership?
Yeah, the way I sort of see it, and I'm not sure if you see it exactly the same, Adam, but I feel like we started this thing together having no idea really what we were doing with it. And then we got to a certain point and we thought a stage show would be a good idea. And I feel like Adam is doing a lot of the stage show driving.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like the show is Adam's interpretation of the story.
Mm.
And then, but it is made with me. Like, we work together to make it, even though it's, like, Adam's version of the story. And I think that the film is going to be my version of the story, but Adam will help me with that as well. So it's not like I'm taking it off to do something alone with it.
Right.
It's a completely collaborative process the whole way through.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's been ongoing for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Have you ever had, has it been difficult? Has it been hard to sustain? Has it been... tell me about that process, because it's quite a close long-term collaboration, I would imagine.
Mm. Well, there was a period of like quite rapid change early in the process when Ben and the camera were a lot more present in my world, and both of us were just like super broke and directionless, and like there were periods where Ben just moved into the spare room in our house and would just hang out.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to like give Ben the chance to talk about their decision making around when to film and when not to film, because I think that that's been quite a tricky thing for you to navigate. But then, in terms of sustaining it, with a transition, there's no end point to a person's transition, and so like the end, finding out what the end point to the story is has been difficult. But it hasn't been something that we've like had the same level of emphasis on catching footage for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really concentrated point early on, and then I'll just ring Ben up and be like, this important thing's happening.
And it was always seen as like, I kind of saw it as an opportunity to go hang out with Adam, and I would just bring my camera along.
So it was that sort of relationship. It wasn't sort of like it wasn't so formal. It sounds quite informal.
Definitely not formal.
That was probably helpful.
Yeah.
So what Adam said about you making calls about when to film and when not to film, would you like to say something about that?
Yeah, I think a lot of the time, again, it was sort of like agreed upon between the two of us, or if Adam had been going through something, I'd be like, hey, would you like to talk to the camera? Do you feel like you want to? And there was some like difficult times, some of which are in the show. The show's kind of focused around one particularly difficult stage of the process. And there was parts where I didn't bring my camera out because I didn't feel like I could. I felt like it was a private like moment that I didn't want to interrupt by saying, hey, can I pull my camera out and point it at this? And I didn't feel like it was... Adam was in a place where he could consent to that properly. And so there's definitely navigation around that, but it was always done as sensitively as I could.
And it sounds like it sounds like the relationship you've got, if something was filmed that was too sensitive or too difficult, Adam's input would be taken into account on that. You're not completely sort of one of those... because I guess as a documentary filmmaker, you know, you're trying to show something, and I guess often that for documentary filmmakers that means you have to make some difficult calls about putting material in it that might be confronting for the person, the subject, but that's needed.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that is a bit toxic in documentary filmmaking. Like, I see it, and I think it, like, I mean, I don't know if I condone it or I don't, or I'm not really sure about it, but I definitely, it makes me uncomfortable to think of myself acting in that way of, like, going in and kind of, like, tricking people into showing me pieces of their lives and then using that to bolster my cred as a doco maker and to try and get some more views or clicks or ratings or whatever, awards or whatever it is now. So I don't really like the idea of kind of like that predatory documentary filmmaking.
Sort of sensationalizing feel about it. Like, but, you know, I was watching a documentary recently on Netflix and they've got to have something that, like, hooks you into the next thing. There's got to be some sort of reveal or some sort of... So will this be the style of your documentary will be a full length documentary?
Yeah.
And so it's not like you're having to kind of have episodes. Was there a thought of making it episodic, or was it always going to be?
We had lots of thoughts that we threw around at the start of it, and we were like, maybe it's just a short doco, maybe it's a series, maybe it's a web series, web series can be like shorter and more rugged and a lot longer running. And then I think more recently I've settled on a feature. I don't really know exactly why I settled on the feature, but I think it just feels like I did some rough cuts and it just feels like it's about the right shape to be a feature, the right size and shape for it.
So let's talk a bit about the show. Did you write the show, Adam? Like, did you write it as a sort of as a script, or was it devised, or how did it come together?
Yeah, I've worked with a few really wonderful collaborators in the script writing process. Like I said earlier, finding the end point of the story was really difficult, but so is, you know, if I'm just looking back at 7 years of my life, figuring out what the narrative is that I want to hook into and highlight has been really tricky. And my mind is one that gets yanked off course quite easily by interesting, shiny stuff. I've definitely needed help in distilling to its core what it is that I want to say with the show.
Right.
The collaborators that have been the most helpful with that are Ni Dekazreihana, who's a theatre maker, actor and director based in Wellington, Eve Gordon, who's like a long-term collaborator of mine and the creative director of The Dust Palace, Daniel Goodwin, who's another trans and queer poet who I've got a long friendship and collaborative artistic relationship with. So yeah, like three quite powerful, very emotionally intelligent and just like incredible artistic people have come in to support. But throughout the process, what I've been finding is the importance of like centering my authorship in this story. It's like, this is a story about me, and I need to tell it in the way that feels the most truthful for what I went through. So a script was developed there. It's all written down. Each night that I perform it, I learn something new. And so, and because it's just me, I'm able to tweak as I go along, which is cool. We've also had a bunch of run-ups at this show. So it was cancelled because of COVID at the end of last year. And the show that I would have made and performed then is totally different than the show that we made and performed this time.
When you say run-up, what do you mean? Like a postponement? Is that kind of...
Yeah, postponements. So it's been postponed significantly twice before our premiere season in Wellington.
Yeah. And that was at BATS?
Yeah.
And that was the first time you'd performed this. How long was your season there?
8 shows over 2 weeks.
Right. And how was that?
Amazing.
Really?
Yeah. It was. There were very significant people who came. Like, all of the key characters from the story at that time were in the audience at some point, which was really important.
Right.
And
so how do you portray them in the show?
Well, we've got footage of them.
Uh-huh.
So, they're literally shown.
Uh-huh, right. So there's a screen with... material.
This is important context. What's the show look like, Ben?
So the show looks like lots of it is Adam telling an important story.
Yeah.
And then supplementing that story with video footage, being like, there's this, you know, here's a thing. I'm going to also illustrate it on the screen or help the screen, like, build the story more to give more context, to, like, fill the thing out a little bit more so it's not just Adam sitting there talking the whole time.
So you'll stop at that point, Adam, and allow the image to the film to tell it to kind of take over?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So I'll introduce the content and then we'll watch it on the screen. And one thing that Eve said, which I really like about what that brings, is that she said that there's more time on stage than you get in a typical theatre show, because we're watching, like, me from 7 years ago processing things and then me now talking about those things.
Yeah.
And so... in like a really tangible way, we've got 7 years of a person's life on stage.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And we can, like, you know, I'm contrasting the way that I think now with the way that I thought then, and how I understand myself now with how I understood myself then.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that format before. It's quite an interesting way to present it. Are there other examples of that that you'd seen, or did it kind of just evolve as a way of making the show? Like,
not that I'd seen.
Yeah.
Not really.
It's kind of like live... I think you use the phrase live documentary, maybe, do you?
Yeah.
This live show combines storytelling and documentary, so...
Yeah.
I saw a film, a doco made with the Beastie Boys.
Uh-huh.
And it was essentially... The Beastie Boys thing was kind of similar, but a lot more extravagant, and it's sort of like a really fancy TED Talk with the... some video in the background complimenting what they were saying. So sort of a similar format to that.
Mm. Yeah, but they don't use, like, you know, theatre and metaphor in the same ways.
Yeah.
And was you, as your will you consider you're a performer in the show, Ben? How do you describe your role?
I have some lines and I mostly lurk in the shadows.
Right. Yeah,
but I'm always there.
So there's no sort of dialogue between the two of you? And
there's a tiny little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I feel like we kind of, like, did that, like Adam said, to almost replicate what it was like going through that process, because that was kind of my role. I was, like, sort of there, would show up quietly, every now and then would be kind of noticeable, every now and then I'd say a few things, just the quiet observation of the thing. So I'm just acting out the quiet observation that I have done over the last 7 years.
Right.
I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so the show's an hour long.
70 minutes.
70 minutes, right, okay. So you said you did an eight show season at BATS, and has it evolved significantly since then, or is it essentially the same? Or
a bit. So BATS, the season was 85 minutes in total, so we've had to snip 15 minutes, and in that length of a program, that's quite a significant chunk of time. So what's coming now is, I think it's a lot cleaner, actually, than what we had in Wellington. It feels more tight. It's essentially the same. It's just been, like, had a good pruning.
I'm curious to know about, you know, having this conversation about being trans and transitioning and stuff like that. Does it, I'm guessing, you know, the transition is a physical transition as well as a sort of transition of your identity. And is that part of the... Is that part of talking about that? Because that's quite a personal thing. Is it a difficult sort of thing to talk about like that?
This is a really important question. Give me a second.
Okay.
There are a lot of trans people who have shared their stories of transition with the world. And we're getting a bit sick of it as a community, because what it means is that the world fixates on the transition, in particular, the, like, visible elements of a person's transition as the identifying features of that person.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, whoa, the interesting thing about you is that you have a beard now and you didn't before, you know, or you've had all these surgeries. And so I was very wary of making another transition story. It takes place over the course of my gender transition, in particular in the early days. And so that is inevitably present in the story, and has, like, it has a significant presence. But what I'm trying to talk about is what it felt like taking on the job of figuring out who I am for myself, and then figuring out how to share that with others.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's not about the transition. It's about me being like, wait a second, hang on. Everyone's told me all these things about myself. Do I agree?
Yeah.
If not, then what do I even think? Mm. Fuck!
Mm. Yeah.
So that's what the story's about.
So has it been, I hesitate to use the word therapeutic for you, but doing having this sort of opportunity to reflect and mm-hmm. to put into words and sort of concretely think it through and to present it as a show and as presented as a documentary, has yeah. that been a good...
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I can't tell you how healing and insightful it's been for me. Mm. There were so many skeletons in the closet, particularly from those early days where I just really derailed myself and the things that I was going through had massive impact on the lives of people that I care about that had haunted me for a long time and I hadn't been able to face. And so the necessity of facing those things in the context of this story with the like central kaupapa being center myself and forgive myself and celebrate myself has just been so profound in the way that I hold not just me back then, but then also the way that I do relationships now and the just like how I'm navigating my life. Yeah, it's been really, really helpful to do it. The documentary was originally my idea and so was the show. They're both things that I felt I needed and I'm getting the things that I hoped I would by doing them.
Wow. That's awesome. What about the title, Man Lessons? I'm kind of, what's that? Because there's a sort of playfulness about that, which I don't know if that's intentional, but...
Yeah, it is. Okay, when I came out as a dude, it made a lot of the types of people that I... It was 7 years ago, right? We're at a different place now with the conversation around trans folk than we were then. Yeah. I was very new, and most of the people that I'd met had never met a trans person before. Mm. And I hung out with a lot of dudes. I worked as a tradie.
Really?
Yeah. And they didn't know how to deal with me at all.
Right.
And the bros had this bit. Like, it was a really familiar bit. And it came at me from lots of different angles and lots of different people. But the bit went like this. Oh, mate. You want to be a man? Well, let me show you how to do something.
Open a beer on anything.
Yeah.
Oh, right. That was a significant man lesson.
Yes. The one that is most crystallized in my mind was there were two builders, Big Brad and Little Brad, and Little Brad taught me how to open a beer with a plank of wood as a way of like inducting me into manhood and teaching me how to be a man.
Right. I mean, it sounds like you put yourself in an environment where masculinity is quite defined and possibly quite narrow.
Mm. I wasn't in that environment for very long.
Right.
I bailed and then just like went full time in the arts after
that. All right. Was that a bit masochistic becoming a tradie as a trans person? I mean, not masochistic, but like what was your real intention to become a tradesperson?
I was working as a painter throughout my uni holidays before I realized I was trans. And it was just way better money and hours than my mates who were working in hospo.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Then I came out as trans and it fucked it all up and I left.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So, Man Lessons. Does that make it into the show? The kind of the idea that you know there are some codified ways of being a male, which you know you could look at and go, because I guess what we were talking about this with the soy boys, and I was like, well, where does the soy boys thing come from? And they said in the States, a soy boy is a sort of a put down by the sort of right, the alt-right, to indicate a lack of masculinity. You know, you're a soy boy, and I guess that's not really familiar to us here. And, you know, on the spectrum of masculinity, we were sort of saying, you know, there's sort of alpha male at one end and gay at the other end. And then what is there in the middle? Maybe metrosexual or, you know, so so it's not a very broad spectrum in terms of ways of being. So the Man Lessons, is that into the show? Is that kind of concept woven into the show?
I want to talk about this one.
Here you go.
I think that the title Man Lessons is kind of like a little bit... what's the right word for it? It's meant to like... kind of like annoy people in the back of their head a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas like I can imagine people who consider themselves very, very manly being like, oh, what kind of fucking lessons are these going to be?
Uh-huh.
And I'll go have a look and then they might actually learn something about accepting themselves.
Yeah, interesting.
Which would be amazing. And also there's definitely, I feel like there'll be people who maybe kind of feel like man space, like there's a lot of male-dominated spaces, and they kind of get annoyed with that, and they may want to show up to, like, get a bit more ammunition and be like, this is crap, and, like, bag on it. And hopefully, again, those people, like, the people who are triggered and a little bit annoyed by the name are the other kind of people that I think would really get a whole lot out of the story.
Right. So you'd welcome them to the show.
Definitely.
You're not expecting a fully necessarily, you know, preaching to the converted, you know, totally on board with trans people, you know. Nah. I'm sure those people are at your show. I'm guessing that it's quite an important thing for them to see it as well.
Yeah, a bunch come. And I had some, like, in Wellington, we had some people who had family members who were trans, and they hadn't been very exposed to these kinds of narratives before, and they got a lot out of it. And then trans people come and they're like, oh, because I'm offering insight into the, like, the existential crises that dominate at that time. A lot of trans folk who came found it quite confronting or beautiful or felt seen in a new way. So it's great if they come, but it's not just for them. I think that for me, the title, we toyed early on with a lot of, I thought the show was going to be way funnier and gaggier than it has turned out. Mm-hmm. And so we had a lot of ideas about, like, what are these kind of tongue-in-cheek lessons that I learned that did not make it into the final version of the show.
Yeah.
But I remember at the time when I was being taught these lessons by the men that I was around, in the back of my head I was like, yes, I've got a high voice and these fat lumps on my chest and I've been socialized a certain way and I, every now and then we'll put on a dress and, you know, I've, like, got this way of being. But I'm a man, therefore this is a way that one can be a man. So would you like some lessons as well? And I think now this is my, like, this is the lessons that I wish that I'd been able to offer those dudes in manhood. You know, like, you can have a breakdown. You can have feelings and confusion and be vulnerable. We all need, you know, like, all of those... dismantle that bullshit toxic masculinity lessons. Yeah, they're making it out now.
Awesome. All right, well, we need to wrap this up because we're about to run out of time. Cool. And it's been really great meeting you and talking to you, Ben and Adam. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been really enjoyable talking to you. I'm hoping to catch Barrier Ninja, which I think is starting right now here at 116.
And we did run over time. Sorry about that, but I hope you enjoyed listening to that interview with Adam Rowe and Ben Sarton, who are the performers in Man Lessons, the live show, which has another performance tonight at 7 p.m. at 116. At the same time, well, just a little bit after that, Bury Me Happy is on at the Fringe After Dark, Brendan Lovegrove, and at 8 o'clock, Maggie Coco's Science for Sociopaths, and then at 8:30 p.m. Stories About My Body, and in a little while we'll be having a chat with Morgana at 10:30, who is the solo performer in that show, which she also wrote. And okay, so I'm going to play a bit of music, and this one I think goes well with the story about becoming a trans person. It's by Ajumal. It's called Above All Else, Be Kind.
There is a wind. A song of sky, of still. If I was struggling for breath, you'd clasp me close, you'd bear my breathing. There is a dark the light can't kill, within the blinding fear it fills. If I were huddling
Fringe Radio. I'm Damien, with you till 12. That was Ajumal and Above All Else Be Kind. Patricia is here making the coffees. Lovey's is open and she makes great coffee. In fact, I haven't had a bad coffee at Lovey's yet, whether it's Kate or Becky or now Patricia or even Reese. Lutz makes a decent coffee as well. So, got a nice stable of baristas. It is hard to mess up a long black, I have to say, but it's possible. And Patricia was just saying that I was just asking her about what she'd been to see at Fringe. And it'd be good to have her actually in the studio because she's got a very charming accent. I'm not sure where she's from, I have to ask her. Spanish somewhere. She went to see two things yesterday. One was the Show Me Shorts Film Festival. She just dropped the program in. And apparently you can watch this online. You didn't have to be there. It was at Forum North yesterday at 6 o'clock. And she said there's some great little films in the lineup, including one called Manny and Quinn, written and directed by Siobhan Marshall. The storyline is an introverted shopkeeper forges a new relationship with the mystery man next door through a playful yet competitive game of dress-ups with their shop Mannequins. Sounds really great. And yeah, the movies look interesting, so I must check them out, especially because you can online. So I'll hang on to that. What else? Also, Patricia went to see the Climate Imaginary show, which was down in, I think, what used to be the waiting room at the hub where the bus station is. And she said it was a great concept with amazing visuals and music. She wasn't sure about the venue, thought maybe a bit more wall space would have been good for the projections, but I'm guessing they took that spot because it's quite visible for people walking. I don't know, visible for people walking past. Down at sort of adjoining Whangarei Art Museum and the hub. So that was interesting. I found wandering around at 116 while the interview was playing, I found a flyer for Ready Set, and they described themselves as a youth indie rock band and a sort of psychedelic swirly picture. And there'll be a collection of koha at the front door, gold coin donation, otherwise it's free. You can book your seat on Event Finder if you search Ready Set, or go to the Whangarei Fringe website and click on and search Ready Set there, and then click on the tile takes you to the Event Finder page. They're also on Instagram. Ready Set the Band is their Instagram, whatever it's called, handle, tag. So coming up in a little while, hopefully around 10:30, I'll be talking to Morgana O'Reilly. Tales of Selling My Toes in NYC, Birth, Boobs, and Trying to Like My Chins. And it's a great show, and some hilarious stories about bodies and accepting your body and how your body changes and the things it can do, especially if you're a woman, and the things you can do with it. It's not a spoiler to say that Morgana had a spell in New York where she... I don't know if... I'm going to ask her this. Was she actually? Did she consider herself a sex worker? She worked in a foot fetish club, and people would pay quite decent money just to, I don't know, fetishize her feet. And that's a substantial part of the story. That's quite amusing. That's where she met her husband. So yeah, enjoyable. And Morgana says on the flyer, I was in Neighbours and Mean Mums and stuff. So she's quite a prolific performer. So that's going to be interesting. And I'm also going to have a chat, hopefully soon, to Alan McElroy. But ahead of that, I had a quick look at his website. The premise for his show is that there's an American, black American TV producer called Alan B. McElroy. Alan McElroy, the New Zealand Alan McElroy, was getting some inquiries from people about the other Alan McElroy, and he made a show about that. And if you can make a show about that, great. And if you can make a show about a cock-shaped weather warning, then all power to you. But in advance of that, I'm just going to play, while I see if Alan's ready, available. I'm going to play something I found on his website, which is called the Bad Gigs Podcast. Says, listen to my hilarious podcast with performers about their bad gigs. So let's do that. Hopefully it will open.
It's gonna take a little time.
Spotify. Yep, looks like it's gonna work.
But with you,
the description goes, who doesn't love a complete disastrous bombing on stage? Well, the performer. And I've been asking stand-ups about this, what's your nightmare gig?
To love God.
And the latest episode
was
Scotty McNair. I've never heard of Scotty McNair.
But
it really matters. David Koryos. That's Koryos. That's not one I have heard of. And so let's listen to that. It's a 30-minute podcast. I'll just play the first. Alan McElroy talking to David Koryos about worst gigs.
How are you doing? And welcome to my new podcast where I talk to comedians about their worst ever gigs and have a laugh about it. And this one, The first one, I talked to one of my favourite comedians and people. It's David Correos. He's all over TV on shows like 7 Days. He's the time-travelling guy on the Vodafone ad and Taskmaster New Zealand. Dave is, according to his webpage, a powerhouse of New Zealand comedy. I've gigged with him loads and it's always fun. And as this is the first one, let's jump right in. That's not piss about. This was recorded in a car park in Paihia for some reason. I can't remember why. And this was the morning after the gig, the night before. That's how time works. Enjoy! Tell us about your worst ever gig.
Worst ever gig?
Worst ever gig.
I got several. What kind of flavour of worst gig do you want?
I like a buffet.
A buffet, okay. One that I had was Love Grove, organised a gig in Whangarei at the Butter Factory.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, I was about 2 years into New Zealand at the time, and then, so I didn't have that much material, and my shtick was still get naked by the end of the show,
yeah,
and that's the big laugh,
yeah, yeah,
that's it, right?
But, that's good shtick.
And it was like, I think the audience was mainly like 50-year-old volunteer firefighters. So I get up on stage, I tell my first joke, it bombs, and I go, oh no. And I'm in my head, I go through all of my best material, which was like not really much. And then what happened was, after about 2 minutes, I'm already completely naked on the stage.
You just went to the punchline
straight
away.
I went straight to the punchline. And after those 2 minutes, I got like a surprise reaction. I don't remember really laughs happening, but there was a surprise reaction. And then all I remember thinking was, I got asked to do a 20-minute set. I got 18 minutes more of this shit to go. And it was just silence. It was just silence for the whole set. And I did. And the worst part was, because I got naked and I reached that point, I had to go back to my observational stuff.
So while you're naked?
Yeah, while I'm naked. So I'm just a fat Filipino dude who's naked telling weird stories about a circumcision while people are looking at it. And then at the very end of the gig, this couple went up to all of the audience members. Oh no, this couple went up to all of the comics, and they went up to each one of them. They were like, "Oh, you were so fantastic! Oh, that was so funny! Thank you so much for coming to Whangarei." And she looks at me, and all of the joy disappears from her face, and she just goes, "You're so brave! You're so brave with what you do."
It's like you're dealing with a fucking illness.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake! Oh, was it really that bad? Oh, Jesus Christ! And I guess that's fucking one of the worst ones I've done.
That's a shocker.
Yeah. What about you?
Oh, my, all right, I'll tell you this one. Me and Alan were booked. This is kind of similar to yours, except I didn't get naked. When I go into panic mode, I go straight into my early material. I don't know how, I just go straight there. I couldn't tell you my early material now, but if I'm standing in front of a load of people who aren't laughing, I go straight to it. And because me and Alan did Edinburgh when we seen you, and we did the Christmas song, the Die Hard song. And on the back of that, we were booked in to close a few shows in Dublin. Mm-hmm. So we were doing a couple of comedy clubs and that. And then someone got in touch with me that owns a big hotel or runs the entertainment in a hotel where a lot of big names used to do, like fucking, Mrs. Brown and all of that.
Oh, wow.
When he was Brendan O'Carroll doing. So we were booked in to do that, but open for an 80-year-old crooner from South Africa. So me and Alan, so they wanted us to do like an hour. So me and Alan did, let's do our stand-up and a bit of the show. So we'll do some of the songs. So we went in to do the gig, and we didn't realise the whole crowd are really old, like really old. And there was people, nobody was there to see us, right? And I got a list of the people that were there so I could prepare jokes. So there was teachers, a group of teachers there, right? So I got Kama Sutra colouring in. So my idea was, if they start talking, I'd walk over and give them colouring in and say, now be quiet and colour in this, right? So, and it was just people having sex. So we walk in, right? And Alan is there before me and he's terrified. And I walk in and he says, have you seen the crowd? And they were really old. Like they didn't want us, right? It was so old. They were there for the crooner, nothing else, right? So we're like, look, we'll just get through this. We've done Edinburgh. We're fresh. We'll just jump out and we do it. We'll start off running around giving gifts to people. And then I'll introduce the show and then bring you on for comedy. Then I'll come on, do comedy, and we'll sing a few more songs. And we finish on a song and then we go home. But we started on Die Hard because that always got people at the comedy club. So we jumped out and we started, hey, everybody, how's it going?
and they were looking at us terrified. So Die Hard, in the song, we sing about not everybody believes in Jesus and Christmas and stuff, so John Lennon should be the new festive hero. And when we reach that point in the song, we rip off our clothes and we have a bloodied vest and we start going, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, now I've a machine gun, ho, ho, ho. But all the old people, they didn't know Die Hard, so they didn't know the reference. So they just saw these two lads stripping in a vest covered in blood, just going, motherfucker, 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 right? So they just didn't like us at all, right? And I could feel the sweat building up. I'm like, oh man, this is torture, right? And I thought, I can get him with stand-up, right? I can get him with that. So we rushed through, we skipped the song, like, while doing it. We said, skip it. And the green room, by the way, was right behind the stage. Literally a door opens onto the stage, right? Yeah. So I did a little bit of crowd work, a bit of banter. Then I said, right, we'll do another song, an environmental song, which we did at a Father Ted event, right? Another song that goes well. And it's environmental, and it's just me shouting weird stuff while Alan is being the straight man. So I was like, this is our environmental song, our mental song. And he's like, yeah. It's like, we need to stop driving cars. And I'm like, kill the fucking cows, right? So I'm shouting all these different things, right? That's a contrast to him being, you know, we need to stop burning. I'm like, stop burning fridges and stuff. All this dumb shit, right? So we start doing that while we're covered in blood still. And I think now is the time. I run down, I do a Bono bit where I get on my knees and goes, we came from the monkeys in the trees, and then we turned into people or whatever. It's just this weird fucking Bono thing with glasses. And I ran down to the table of teachers, and I start doing that, and I'll never forget this. The woman just looked at me and goes, what's wrong with you? I just looked at me and goes, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, oh my God, they hate us. They fucking hate us. So I jumped up, did some crowd work, kind of got them on board to what we were doing. I said, I'm going to introduce my friend, he's from Cork. So I reeled it in a bit because it was too mental at the start. Alan has really nice material, really, really nice, pleasant, affable material. I brought him out, I went backstage and I sat there, I started having a fucking panic attack. I was like, I can't do this, this is not. And the old crooner came in and he was angry at what we did. He was angry that we broke his room. So he was sitting in the same room. He didn't want us in his green room either. Mm-hmm, so it was just weird. And I'm just sitting there like fucking hunched over, tail between my legs. And then Alan was supposed to do, say, 20 minutes. I'd say 7 minutes, the door to the stage just opens. And Alan goes, they hate me. And I can see the crowd. I can see them through the door. He's like, what? Just, yeah, they hate me. They're not laughing at me. He goes through. He's like, you better go out. I'm like, what the fuck, man? So I jumped out and I start doing some stuff and I start doing material. And then I got to the end.
Is it working?
I was kind of getting them, I'm kind of winning them over, because it's about kids and stuff, and I'm like, you got kids, yeah, you got kids. The Kama Sutra thing didn't go down well at all, by the way. At one point I ran over, here's your colouring in, and they're like, this is offensive. I'm like, oh, fuck off, right? Fuck off, what are you doing here, right? So I start doing material, everything was going better, and then, so I was like, right, we're going to wrap up with a couple of songs. We have a song about Brexit, and a song about Hakuna Matata, right? Yeah, yeah. So it's Fuma Mata. It's about people buying cigarettes in Portugal and Spain because it was cheaper. So it's all about, it's like, Fuma Mata. What? It means non-smoking in Portuguese, right? It's a fucking... But the thing is, we dress up in onesies while doing it. Like, I'm a giraffe and he's a zebra. And it's kind of fun.
Not even the right animals.
You can't get a fucking warthog onesie, you know, in the shop, going to the warehouse. So we're up singing the song. They have no idea what's going on. But before we got into that, I finished my bit and I said, right, what we're going to do now is bring Alan back on and we're going to sing another couple of songs. Who wants to see Alan? And they all went, no. All right, but this is, oh God, okay. So then, so he came out, we sang the songs, and then we didn't even look at the crowd. The guy who was on next hated us, his kids hated us, the crowd hated us, and my picture was all over the fucking hotel. I was trying to rip down the posters on the way out. It's like, I didn't want my name associated with this. And then we were supposed to do two nights, and I literally didn't get out of bed the whole next day. The fucking anxiety was too much, and I lay in bed, And my dad, who knew we were doing the show, he was excited. And he was like, yeah, it was the show. I was like, don't want to talk about it. And then my mother was like, oh, really bad. And Alan had got a furniture from IKEA, a sofa, and he spent the whole day just turning screws because of his anxiety. He couldn't handle it either. Didn't speak for the whole day because we didn't want to do the gig. We were dreading it.
Yeah.
And then eventually I get a text from the guy who booked us. He said, we got a lot of complaints about you last night. So many complaints. So we're gonna cancel your gig tonight, and we're gonna get someone else. They got some drag artist in, and we were delighted. We were fucking delighted. I call up Alan. He's like, "How are you?" He goes, "Not good." And I goes, "What are you up to?" I'm just putting the sofa together from IKEA. He's like, for the whole day, he's sitting there doing the sofa. And I was like, "You ready for tonight?" "No, I don't want to do it." "Don't want to do it." Because sometimes, you know yourself in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes I came down to the kitchen and he was sitting there drinking whiskey, saying, "Can't do this anymore. Can't do this. I'm like, "Come on, man. There's two of us together." And times he's walked in and I'm drinking cider in my underpants. And I'm like, "Fuck the festival. I'm not doing it anymore. I can't handle this," right? So that's what it was. So I wound him up. I said, "Look, man, we need to do this. We need this money." He's like, I can't do it. I can't do it. He started freaking out. And then I said, what are you messing? We got sacked.
That is Alan McElroy on his podcast, Bad Gigs. And that was him talking to David Koryos. I didn't know. And it's funny, they started off with an anecdote about performing at the Butter Factory here in Whangarei with Brendan Lovegrove. I couldn't have been at that gig because I'd have remembered a naked Filipino man for 20 minutes. So anyway, Brendan Lovegrove is on tonight here in Whangarei again. His show called Bury Me Happy, which I guess is self-explanatory. So that gives you a taste of Alan. I'm hoping to catch up with Alan in a bit, but he's busy in Wellington, so he might not be available. So we'll just carry on. Let's have a song. How about this one? It's called No Hard Feelings by the Avett Brothers.
My body won't hold me anymore, and it finally lets me free. Will I be ready when my feet won't walk another mile and my lips give their last kiss goodbye? Will my hands be steady when I lay down my fears, my hopes and my doubts, the rings on my fingers and the keys to my house, with no hard feelings? When the sun hangs low in the west and the light in my chest won't be kept, held at bay any longer. When the jealousy fades away and it's ash and dust for cash and lust, and it's just hallelujah and love and thought, love in the words, love in the songs they sing in the church, and no hard feelings. Lord knows they haven't done much good for anyone. Kept me afraid and cold with so much to have. body won't hold me anymore. And it finally lets me free. Where will I go? Will the trade winds take me south through Georgia grain or tropical rain or snow from the heavens? Will I join with the ocean blue or run into a savior true and shake hands laughing and walk through the night straight to the light, holding the love I've known in my life and no heart feelings. Lord knows they haven't done much good for anyone. Kept me afraid and cold with so much to hide.
Oh, that's a beautiful song by the Avett Brothers from their album True Sadness, No Hard Feelings. okay, so I'm going to be talking to Morgana O'Reilly at 10:30. I thought ahead of that I would play my interview yesterday with the Soy Boys, in case you missed it. Quite enjoyed having them in the studio. Unfortunately, I didn't make it to their show. So let's hear what they had to say, and then it'll be closing on 10:30. We're having a chat with Morgana. Oren and Finn, and then at 11:30 we've got Adam from Man Lessons. So welcome to the studio, Oren and Finn. You've already had one show here at Fringe After Dark?
Yes, we have.
Cool. And
it's last night.
Yeah, it's a nice venue, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a gorgeous venue.
Yeah,
it's quite big as well.
You just walk in and it says, you know, sort of not sleazy comedy venue, but like, you know, those curtains, if you look, don't look too closely, they're kind of old and, you know, a bit tatty, and yeah, I just perfect. I like the vibe. Yeah. So your title of your show is Soy Boys, and definitely in your description of the program, there's a sort of milk theme. where did that come from? Like, what's the, you know, how did you decide on that?
So there's a sort of there's an idea in the States around sort of right wing groups where they are labeling sort of more left wing, more effeminate men as soy boys.
Okay. So it's a put down to some sort of non macho version of masculinity kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. And we kind of felt that that described us.
Uh-huh. and you're kind of maybe reclaiming it as a sort of like, you know, a badge of honor to be a kind of more, I don't know, what would you call it? Like, because in the spectrum of masculinity, there's basically kind of alpha male and gay at the two ends.
Yeah.
And exactly. So, you know, metrosexual was sort of like somewhere in between.
Yeah.
And so, but metrosexual was not necessarily a put down. It was more like a
trying to find some space on the spectrum for people who aren't gay.
It's more of a trend, really, wasn't it?
I guess so, yeah. So you're kind of referencing that. Okay, and are people in New Zealand familiar with that as a sort of a thing? Because I definitely wasn't. Like, I read it and I was like, okay, what is this about?
Very few people are.
Okay, do you explain that in the show?
Not really. Okay. Not really. Okay. But I think that kind of works. It still works fine as long as people get maybe just have a feeling of what it might be.
Yeah.
And I guess it also kind of means that we can talk about whatever we want
outside
of stuff about masculinity, which I think we had material about that.
Right.
That's why we were together.
Okay. Oh, yeah. See. So that was sort of what drew you together to do a show together, kind of.
Yeah. Well, we're both sort of working towards having longer stand-up comedy sets, and we both have roughly half an hour now, and our material is somewhat similar, has similar themes around.
Sort of complements each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Right.
Mm. Yeah. So yeah, that's why we decided to partner up for this show.
And how long have you been working together, doing the show?
Well, including the hour last night, probably. And we've known each other for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
But in terms of working time together, probably an hour.
Oh. So last night was your debut?
Yeah. And then I guess we've just been performing on the same lineup shows in Wellington for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
Just developing our stuff individually.
Cool. So I understand from talking to stand-up comedians through the fringe, you know, the sort of start-off seems to be like a 10-minute set.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can do lineups, and then you can kind of like expand it to half an hour, and then you can do a split bill show, like I guess is what yours is. Is it a split bill show? You're not on together. You're doing separate sets.
Yeah, we're not on stage at the same time.
And then an hour. So then the kind of the holy grail, according to, I was talking to Ryan McGee. I don't know if you've met him.
Yes, of course. Oh, yeah.
You probably know the circuit, you probably all know each other.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, it's very tight knit.
Okay. And he was talking about getting up to that hour where you can do an hour on your own, and then he said you get an agent.
Essentially, I do. Well, that sounds good.
Yeah.
is that the goal? Like, so you've both been working in stand up for about 2 years, did you say, in Wellington?
Yeah,
give or take.
Two years ish. I mean, you don't really. 2020 is a weird year because you couldn't hardly perform.
Right.
But I guess we were stand up comedians then.
Mm.
But yeah, I guess that is the goal. I'm not sure. We maybe have similar takes where we just are focusing on comedy and are not too good with the whole business or marketing or admin.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you've got to be good at that stuff too, or?
I think inevitably.
You have to promote yourself.
Inevitably, you have to. You have to do it.
You are kind of the product and the marketer. And
right.
You are the whole.
I guess that's the beauty of it. It's quite portable, isn't it? You're in terms of overheads, you know, it's just you.
Well, exactly. That's kind of the appeal of what drew me to it in the first place is that, once you get your first hour, you can go anywhere. And as long as you have a venue and seats for people to sit in, you've got a show.
Yeah. So when did you realize that you were funny, or when did you kind of like, you know, there must have been a moment where you thought, because I wouldn't do stand-up, like I just don't think I'm that funny, but you must have had a moment where you're like, and sometimes I think, was it because you were a little shit at school and you would, you know, you're pissing the teachers off but everyone was laughing, or like when was it for you, Finn?
Well, it's funny. A lot of people ask my sister that question. And whether
about you.
Well, yeah, because my sister comes to quite a lot of my stand-up shows, and people ask her, like, well, was he, like, funny as a kid? And more often than not, she says no.
Yeah.
She was more the funny one. So I honestly don't think that I was, like, I don't know if people would have seen me as a kid and been like, he's going to be a stand-up comedian. I think it was more so, I did, like, drama and things at the time, and then it just sort of, stand-up comedy is an offshoot of theatre, which is, again, more portable.
Yeah.
But also, it's a lot more fun.
Really? More fun than theatre?
I would say, in a few ways. And in some ways, theatre is more fun than stand-up comedy, but it's, I don't know, I think it's a lot more lighthearted, and I think I enjoy it a lot more.
Mm.
And again, I think it's more of a skill that you learn to write jokes and deliver jokes, and you can be not funny at the start, and then after a few years develop that muscle, that skill. So
it's definitely a sort of a craft that you have to develop, as well as having a kind of, I don't know, like a take on the world. You must have some sort of, you know, I guess as a stand-up, you've got to have an opinion on everything. yep. or start something.
Yeah.
What would you say your material kind of is about generally? Like, is it because yep. observational? Is that
so, that's like, a, yeah, that's a style.
Because I had Alexander Sparrow came in earlier in this week, and he was like, "Insult comedy." That's where I'm at. And, and then I went to see his show, and I was like, "I totally understand what that genre of comedy is."
Yep. Yeah.
Oren,
yeah.
what's your kind of?
Yeah, I think we're both kind of similar, but I guess we generally we have some quite personal stories,
mm-hmm.
storytelling, and yeah, I guess there's sometimes stories that turn out to be funny.
Yeah.
I guess, and I think...
Don't sound funny to begin with.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Like, I think, like, I realized I was funny, or at least some of my experiences were funny, when I just told the truth.
Yeah.
And that's... And I'm often up on stage thinking, why are they laughing?
Yeah.
And then I get off and ask, well, why was that funny? And it's just something kind of unfortunate. And then there's the other half where I think that might be funny, and it takes me a while to work out why that is funny.
But those sorts of experiences happen to all of us. So exactly. It's really just the way you tell them, isn't it, as a comedian?
Exactly. And we were staying... So we were staying with someone at the moment, and he was a bus driver in the crowd, and we didn't know that. And so we turned up to his house afterwards to stay, and then there was the person in the crowd.
Wait, so this is here in Whangarei?
Here in Whangarei, yes. Wait,
so the person you're staying with here in Whangarei is a bus driver?
Was
in well, he yeah. came to the show, yeah. And at the start we did a little bit of talking to the crowd,
yeah.
And got to know this guy who was a bus driver,
uh-huh.
Made a couple jokes in and around him, nothing too mean or anything.
Luckily.
Yeah, luckily. yeah, and then we arrived back at the place that we were staying and realised that it was him. It was because we hadn't actually spoken face to face before.
Oh, I see. So they're people put like billeting you, putting you yeah. up for the show, for the festival.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
So right. So carry on.
Yeah, but I mean, he was talking about how in our stories, it was just the fact that we were just telling stories that relate to people.
Yeah.
Even though they're our very maybe like personal and individual experiences,
yeah.
but everyone has something or a memory that they can really quite strongly relate to it.
Yeah.
And they're willing to listen to those parts in kind of a nice way.
Yeah.
And then the joke lands and then it turns out to be funny. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we're always expecting a punchline, aren't we? We're there to laugh. Like, we're there because we want to be entertained.
Mm.
But also, I think there's something very compelling about a story, isn't there? Like, we love listening to stories. So yep. The minute someone starts telling me a story, I'm there.
Exactly.
And, so, all right, so maybe would you be willing to share with us one little kind of thing that you talk about in the show, like an anecdote that would, you know, the kind of thing, could give us a taste of the kind of thing?
Do you want to share the doctor story?
The doctor story? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll tell this story because I didn't actually tell this last night, but there were a couple of doctors at the show,
uh-huh.
and we met them afterwards and I told them the story. So my last girlfriend was in 2019.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't actually spend much time together because we were both quite busy at that time.
Yeah.
And she had quite a big following on social media, and she was a professional dancer.
Oh.
And she was also in her fourth year of med, studying med.
Wow.
And I had stuff on as well. And and as I found out, med was killing all of her time, right?
Yeah. It tends to be all-consuming, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, it's ridiculous hours, lots of study. Mm. And so when you're in your fourth year of med, you get placed in a surgery team in a hospital.
Right.
And you're not performing, you're just in the theatre
right.
observing things. And while we were going out, she was in the colorectal surgery team.
Right.
As in rectal surgery.
Yeah, right.
And everything was going fine. And then one day she just came into my flat and said, I can't do this anymore.
And talking about colorectal surgery or the relationship?
That's exactly the joke. I don't even have to finish it.
Sorry.
And that's exactly it. But that was it. And, you know, it turns out she was talking about me.
Oh.
But that's... And you so, clip that. That's the sort of heaviness that you might get in our show. And then it turns out to be funny. I didn't tell that one last night, by the way.
Okay, right.
I just told that to the two very concerned doctors after the show.
I see. Yeah. And I'm sure they could relate to that. But yeah, so self-deprecating is the kind of the word that comes to mind. Is that, would that be a good description of your sort of comedic style? Like, because, you know, your girlfriend had to choose between colorectal surgery and you.
Yes.
And she chose colorectal surgery.
She was looking at anal fissures.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah, but I guess sometimes it's self-deprecating, but often it comes out the other side and you're making jokes where the audience, it's also uplifting at the same time.
Yeah.
And you have both of those. It can't just be sad. No. It can't just be said, even if it is funny as well. I think the audience, they like to know that we're all good. And we are all good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Finn? What could you give us an example? Give us a taste of your stuff? Like what? Yeah. Sorry to put you on the spot.
It is a bit... we do have quite similar... We discussed last night after listening to the show and listening to us doing both the half hours.
Oh, you record it?
We didn't record this one, but we're recording it this evening. We do usually record our sets.
Do a post-mortem and think what worked and what didn't?
Essentially, hopefully it's not a post-mortem.
Yeah, that's the wrong term.
Unless we killed.
Yeah, true. Unless, yes, yep, right.
But no, we do usually go back and sort of dig apart what happened and what landed, what didn't land, how can we change it and stuff like that. Yeah, we did notice, though, a lot of our jokes sort of start with, this really awful thing happened to me.
Oh, yeah.
And then we find a way to make it funny.
Yeah, that's quite a compelling beginning to a story. I'm already interested. What was the really awful thing? Can you give us a...
I moved into a new flat relatively recently.
Mm-hmm.
This is true. I didn't realize how shit the new place was. I don't know if we can...
No, you can swear. We encourage swearing on this radio station.
Oh, amazing.
We've got no advertisers to piss off, so you say what the fuck you like.
Ah, beautiful. Yeah, I didn't realize how shit the new place was until I moved in. For example, just a few off the top of my head, I went to put a wash on first night that I was there, and a cockroach crawled out of the washing machine, which... You know, it's the cleanest place in the house.
Right. Okay. So the comedian's skill is to turn something like that, which happens into, you know, you've got to kind of think it through for us. Because, yeah, I'm there with the cockroach in the washing machine. That's weird, but you kind of, the cleanest, theoretically the cleanest place in the house.
Exactly.
So what was the pantry like?
Yeah. Like opening up the fridge and finding the sun. I don't know.
Yeah.
What else is going on in that flat? Yeah.
I see. Right. Cool. Yeah, so do you think as a comedian you have to kind of go out and have those experiences, or do you feel like everyday life provides enough material?
I don't know if we necessarily go out and do research.
Because relationships and, you know, what you're describing, moving into a flat, you know, they're all common experiences that we have, aren't they? Is relationships quite a big part of your sets, like talking about being in relationships?
Probably is for me.
Yeah?
I don't know. That might sound bad, but yeah, no, it is. I guess it's
very universal, isn't it? Something we can all understand and relate to.
Yeah, exactly. And I think because it is a kind of a good concept, but what I'm very careful of in terms of going out and having experiences, that I'm never going into experiences thinking, oh, this might be good comedy material.
Yeah,
because then it kind of loses the authenticity.
Yeah,
and usually it's not until for me at least a couple months later until I write about it and then find the humour or realise that it was funny at the time. I think I just don't like the idea of using experiences for comedy or using genuine authentic relationships.
There must be limits, like your partner probably doesn't want you, you know, airing your dirty laundry in public or you know, doing that sort of thing. And do you know Thomas Chapman?
Love Thomas.
he was up here for the Fringe and he told us a story in the studio. He was here with Gavin Hewitson about going to an orgy. Have you heard that story?
I have heard that story.
Oh my god, it's funny because other comedians have asked, they've all heard the story, and I'm like, why isn't it in your show, Thomas? He's like, oh, that's just me living my life. And maybe that's an example of you saying that not everything is necessarily material. So who are some comedians, I've been exposed to some really, like, his name slips my mind, but there's some out there comedians that I've never heard of that people have talked about. Who are your kind of go-tos for?
I'd say my biggest inspirations would probably be someone like Stuart Lee.
Yeah, I do know Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
I really like Stuart Lee. He comes across as very smart.
Yeah, he's very, very clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also a bit neurotic and almost falling apart at times.
Yeah.
Which is, I just think, is a beautiful energy to capture on
stage. Do you think, is that a persona or is that...
Yeah, so it is a persona.
Yeah.
Because
he writes reviews and things like that for The Guardian as well. Like, he's quite you know, he's quite diverse in his... And I saw something the other day which I, you know, said, look, he's grown a beard and he looks like he might be becoming a bit of a derelict. And I'm like, he's just doesn't seem like that kind of, you know, self-destructive comedian. Like, there's a thing about comedians, you know, sometimes they can be quite self-destructive. They can be sort of like on the edge of, you know, suicidal despair as well as being funny, you know, that kind of thing.
No, we're well aware of that stereotype.
It is a stereotype, isn't it?
Yeah.
So sorry, Stuart Lee. Anyone else that you love to watch?
James Acaster.
Right. Yeah. Someone else talked about him. What is it about James Acaster that you like?
He just very funny, and I think he is. He's very clever, and I think he finds comedy in places that not a lot of people would find it.
Right.
Or not a lot of people would look.
Yeah.
Like just in like subtle sillinesses.
Yeah.
And likewise, a lot like us, finds it in sad stories.
Right.
He has a four-part book, like 4 hours of comedy that all is about the worst year of his life.
Really?
His most recent two-hour comedy special is about the worst year of his life, and the four-part special is about him breaking up with his girlfriend, having a big identity crisis, but he veils that with... these silly anecdotes about him pretending to be an undercover cop and all of that sort of stuff. And I think that's having sort of the contrast of the silliness with the quite crushing sadness of something like that. I think he's, as much as he probably wouldn't admit it, I think he is changing the way that people perceive comedy. And I think that...
Right.
Yeah, he, in becoming more mainstream, is sort of shifting comedy away from the whole, like... shock humor and going crazy type comedy, and more in terms of building more personal stories that really hit close to home. That's what I
What about you, Aaron? Do you have similar tastes to Finn, or
I don't, Finn's kind of got me listening to those two. But my two are so Dylan Morn. People mostly probably know him in New Zealand if they watched Black Books a while ago.
Yeah, he's also in one of my favourite movies, Shaun of the Dead.
Yes, yep, in Shaun of the Dead. Yeah, that's another one. Yeah, he plays a good role in that.
Yeah,
he's very observational.
Yeah,
can make things very silly. Like uses language really well.
Yeah,
Has
he got a persona? Like, I was wondering about personas. Like, do you guys, are you on stage? Are you yourself, or are you a persona? You know, like.
Yeah, well, the thing about to Dylan Morin, I hope I'm saying his name right, but he used to be that persona, like the drunken Irish philosopher, when he was probably when he was 20s and 30s, and now he's in I think his 50s, where he's no longer that kind of character. So I'm watching him when he's no longer the drunken person,
right. Okay, I'm going to fade those guys out and put a song on, and I'm going to give Morgana a call, and hopefully without a studio engineer here, set it up so that it works so we can talk to her by phone. So I think this is quite an appropriate song. Hopefully it's not going to affect cell phone reception too much. The Rains by Henry Jamison.
And the trees blow around, in the gathering gale, as I loose my bloodhound upon the trail. And the rains came heavy from the north, and they were all outside, but I was not. I was in the kitchen looking out over the fields. Standing in the doorway, watching the light. came heavy from the north. They were in their little boats. But I was not. I was in bed. And I had pillow bite. In my dream I sleepwalk. And I drink a beer. Doris Day at the cafe down the block. So drink your beer. Drink your coffee. In the fear of the great nothing.
That was The Rains by Henry Jamison from his album The Wilds, and hopefully you can hear me. Morgana, are you still there? Are you still there, Morgana? Hold on, what am I doing wrong? Oh, just lost the call. Okay, well, that's what happens. Live radio, let's try it again. Okay, so having technical difficulties, but it's Beagle Radio, so you should be used to that. So let's try one more time.
Yoda.
Hello, is that Morgana?
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me, Morgana? Okay, let me try this.
Hello.
Hi, is okay, let's see if we can make this work.
Now I can hear you.
Okay. Cool. All right. Just bear with me 1 second. Right, okay. So how's that?
It's good.
Okay. And I think you're coming across on the radio as well. So you're currently driving up from Auckland to Whangarei?
I am.
Right. Is it raining?
No, it's just grey. Rain's great.
Okay. It's quite rainy up here, but we're looking forward to welcoming you to Whangarei. And you've never performed or never been to 116 before?
I haven't, no. But I have heard so much nice things.
Yeah.
Anybody who has been there always sings its praises.
Yeah.
That's a good sign.
That's a very good sign, and I think it's sort of getting quite firmly on the map as a venue, which is great because Whangarei needs that. And we're having a great time at Fringe, and you're coming up on one of the busier days to do your show, Stories About My Body. Two performances, one today at 8:30 and one tomorrow at 8:30 p.m. And tickets are available on the Whangarei, if you go to the Whangarei Fringe website and click on the tile which says Stories About My Body. You can buy tickets there. So, Morgana, I'll be honest. I've seen the show already. I saw it when it was when you were doing it at Q Theatre.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Was that the first time you'd performed it?
No, I performed it. It had its first proper performance. Well, I guess you could say in my backyard. It was going to be performed at the Basement last year, and then Delta stole my season.
Uh-huh.
And then I had booked in to go to the Melbourne International Comedy Festival earlier this year.
Mm.
And as the time came close to that, I realized, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to do the show. I can't just walk into Melbourne and do it there for the first time, you know, so much of it.
Right.
is feeling it out with an audience, because it's a conversation, even though I'd rather the audience don't talk back. and so I did two nights in my backyard, which I thought was very fitting. If you've seen the show, you'll understand the sort of analogy of like a full almost 40-week gestation and then followed by a home birth.
Yeah.
In my backyard with my friends. And then I did it at Melbourne Comedy Festival. And then I came back and did it at the basement and then did a season at Q. And that's gone really well, so I'm going to do it again at Q, which is nice.
Great.
Later in the year.
And has the show changed and evolved much through the experience of performing it?
Yes, only in its rhythms. And like, I think the wonderful thing about working with an audience is that it's just about communicating ideas. So you can feel it out, right, as a storyteller, whether how best to organize your sentences and things like that, and what things tickle people's fancy and what don't. And so the guts of the show has not changed, the vision of it and everything, but just this morning I did do a little bit of like a sweep through the script,
right,
just to make the little changes. But predominantly it's just the same.
Where did the idea for the show come from? Sort of, has it been something you've, because I've just had a quick look at your online profile on Wikipedia, and it says you wrote a play in 2009, the height of the Eiffel Tower. Is this your second original piece then?
I wrote my last solo show. This is the audacity of youth, obviously. I wanted to travel around the world and I didn't want to get a normal job, so I just made a solo show and then I don't have to pay other actors and I can just fundraise for myself.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And so I did that, and that was a show. It was a lot different to this one in that it was, this one is a direct address to the audience.
Yeah.
It's really storytelling.
Yeah.
And whereas that one was a full play with different characters and switching between them, it was very physical.
Also a comedy? But, was it a comedy, the height of the Eiffel Tower?
Yeah, I think in a similar way to this one, I think, which is what I love to do, is use comedy as a way of knuckling into our sweet little softy heart box and then allowing some pathos toward the end.
Yeah.
So that's what that had. But it was also like wonderfully lo-fi, so it really literally only required a chair, and I would do it in people's living rooms. So I did it before I went overseas, and then I started doing it in people's living rooms as I was traveling as a way to say, thank you for letting me stay.
Uh-huh.
I can't pay you, but I can give you a show. And then sometimes I would invite friends around, and I would pass around a hat, and they would pay koha, or as obviously I had to say overseas, donation. And that really helped me survive as an artist for about 5 years.
Sorry, I've just lost Morgana there. Fucking hell. Be back with you in a second. Just trying to get Morgana back online. Hi, Morgana. Sorry about that.
Hello.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
A little bit now where I can't hear you.
Okay.
You're gonna.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay. Great. I'll try and avoid that happening again. Sorry about that. So Morgana, you were saying about using the show to travel and it was so you got to live your dream and yes. Take it around the world.
Yes, and it was great. I do it in really weird places, like on Venice Beach and Burning Man, and all the way through to a little Greyland villa full to the brim with Crownland crockery.
Right.
In 2014, I think I did my last one.
Right.
At the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was having babies and stuff, which was another kind of, not solo work, obviously. It takes another person. two-hander.
Yeah.
And this show was kind of just an accumulation of a lot of stories.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Is it terrifying to perform? I mean, I don't want to give away the beginning too much, but you know, you really go there. Oh shit! Are you still there?
Hello.
Hi. Are you still there?
Oh,
fucking hell. Hello. Are you still there? Sorry about this, listeners. This is really frustrating. Hi, Morgana, are you still there?
Hello. Yes, I am.
Okay, I'm sorry about this. It's really frustrating. I'm not really sure what's happening, but something's happening. Anyway, we'll try and carry on. I can hear you.
Thank you.
Okay, so...
this show came because it's a collection of stories and funny things, but also... a chance to kind of rant on the things that have been going around in my head for the last, you know, 8 years, where my body has changed from being somebody in their late 20s to being somebody in their late 30s, and seeing how the world doesn't really talk about that. Anyway, I made a show that I really wanted to see. That was the sort of gist, yeah. I think.
That's a good starting point. So the question I asked just before we got into technical difficulties again was, is it terrifying for you to do? Because you really go there, you really put your body on the line right from the beginning of the show.
It's not terrifying. It was at the start, but in an invigorating way. Most times straight before a show, like right when I'm waiting to go on, I often am looking in the mirror going, why the fuck are you doing this? Sorry, I swore.
No, it's all right, you can swear on the station.
You're a crazy person.
Yeah.
But then I come off and I feel great. So I think it is... I feel like everybody's got their own kind of flavour of adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can go extreme. Some people, like, bungee jump and do mad stuff like that. People go surfing. Sometimes I reckon there's probably a rush from even, like, cramming in an exam or something like that.
So it's quite...
I like to put myself through a little bit of... scare myself a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's quite... Is liberating? Is it quite a good feeling like that of sort of doing that? Like, putting yourself out there in front of...
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, well, who the hell else is going to do it? You know, like, if you feel like you can do it.
Mm. Yeah.
Especially with something like this, which is speaking in public, and not only speaking in public, but, like, bearing all in public.
Yeah.
It's especially seeing how it has made people feel. Like, it just warms my heart. People that come up to me, not even straight after the show, maybe weeks after having seen it, and they'll get teary-eyed because it made them feel stuff that they can still feel, and that's an honour to facilitate, you know?
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, because when I saw it at Q, I looked around and the audience was, I'd say, predominantly women. Is that been your experience so far, or what's your audience makeup like?
Well, I think it is predominantly women, but, I mean, it's a funny one. I've had people point that out to me a lot. But then I also feel like predominantly women in audiences anyway. It's usually women who book tickets for things anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But then I've had beautifully profound responses from men. So it doesn't have to be all women. It's sort of a shame. I hope that men aren't afraid to come. I don't make men feel like shit.
No.
But I've had some really beautiful responses from men. Like, a friend of mine, well, a new friend, that I don't know him very well. He's in his late 30s, single, doesn't have children. He came and saw the show, and he went, like, I could hear him.
Wow.
And afterwards, he was like, I'm sorry, I'm actually really, really surprised at my response. Like, so resonates for women.
Mm.
But I think there's, I hope there's a lot for men as well and everything in between.
Yeah, I mean, the, particularly for me, the bit that sticks in my mind is the story about you being in New York. And I was going to ask you about that. You know, I was thinking, were you... when you were working in a foot fetish club, and I can't remember if you actually sort of thought of yourself as a sex worker exactly, but you're kind of in the sex industry, I suppose. And, you know, a really beautiful story in itself, you know, and how enjoyable it is to be told a story like that.
Yeah, totally. Oh, that's so great. I love that that sticks in your mind. It is. It's a great story. Like, why else do stuff like that?
Well, it was sort of. It was sort of necessity as well as. I can't. I think you know. You. I seem to remember you had some options, but they were all pretty badly paid, and that one at least paid a decent hourly rate, and it wasn't. It was bizarre, but it wasn't. It wasn't like completely selling your body.
Yeah. No. It was just the right amount of. Danger, I think, that I had the stomach for.
Yeah.
It was perfect.
Yeah.
It was the right amount of weird as well. Like, I definitely, I don't talk explicitly about this in the show, but I definitely thought about stripping.
Yeah.
But I, well, actually, weirdly, I don't think I had the same, the kind of confidence in my body that I needed, even though I totally had a dance background.
Yeah.
But I didn't quite have the, I don't know if they had it in me for that. But then when I saw the ad for foot worship parties, I was like, oh, yeah, I can totally, I've got great feet.
You really had confidence in your feet. And
yeah.
It sounds like the, your, I don't know if you'd call them clients, but they definitely agreed. And what a strange and wonderful world we live in. And I think that's sort of, my takeaway from the show at the end, when that quite profound and moving, you know, sequence of you giving birth, hopefully that's not a spoiler, but was really, I'd never seen anything like that before. I mean, I'd obviously seen videos of people giving birth, but in the context of the rest of the show, it starts with you coming out with not much on and ends with you giving birth. And I'm like, what? You really went all the way. And such a apparently sort of routine, or not routine, but normal thing to do is giving birth. Actually, to watch it like that is incredible. Did your husband fully? Because the other thing about the foot story is that you meet your future husband through that phase of your life.
Yes. Well, just to be clear, I don't meet him through the foot fetish.
No.
Party.
No.
Sorry. I meet him in New York at a similar time.
Yes, yes, good to clarify that.
He was not at the party.
No, that's so. What's his sort of? Has he been involved in the sort of process of making the show?
Oh my gosh, he's just like unendingly supportive and amazing, and also because he's an incredible artist himself, he's really great. He's been and he is really great at helping to refine. The story for me, you know, he was one of the first people I showed the sort of loose sketch to, and like initially the birth stuff was right at the end, like as an afterthought. I was too scared to show the video.
Yeah.
So I sort of did this dance routine, this silly dance routine while the video was playing at the end after I told the story, and you know, he was one of the people that was like, you need to show it while you're telling the story. It's so good.
Wow.
He also has helped me heaps with the video aspect of it. There's just a little sort of peppering of beautiful images through it, and
yeah,
it's just always awesome. There's absolutely never ever been any moment where he's gone, oh, I'd rather you not do that in front of people, which is great.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So what was he doing in New York when you met him?
Well, he was actually just kind of on holiday. He'd just finished, he's a director,
right,
and filmmaker, and which is crazy because essentially we're both in the same industry, but we've never met before, and we both live in Auckland.
Yeah.
And brought up in Auckland, so it's madness. And he just finished a job. He just actually finished directing a show called This Is Not My Life. I don't know if you remember that one, but that was about 13 years ago.
Right.
And him and some friends have taken themselves off on a holiday, which is also
Yeah.
Freelance artist to find guests for holidays. I'm constantly trying to go, like, how, when are we going to have a holiday instead of constantly hustling? so, yeah, they had gone off to Cuba and I think Jamaica and then up to New York. And I met him at a friend's birthday party and then we just got to hang out.
Right.
Oh, look, I'm about to go through a tunnel. I'm about to go through a tunnel for about 3 minutes.
Okay. All right, well, let's wrap it up quickly. I just would love to ask you, what's your favourite thing to do as an actor? Is there a specific thing that you love? Is this it? A solo show? Is there a better buzz than that?
I don't think there is a favourite. I think just like food, depending on what you've just eaten,
yeah,
you might want out different afterwards.
For sure.
So all of the acting stuff, I do often use the analogy of working in a kitchen.
Yeah.
So it's all like different snacks. And sometimes you're just desperate to do a bit of drama, and sometimes you're desperate to do a bit of comedy, and sometimes you're desperate to get your kid off, and sometimes you just don't want to do any of it. So, yeah.
Great. All right, well, let's say goodbye before you go through the tunnel. It's been lovely talking to you, Morgana, and I hope you have a safe journey, and we look forward to welcoming you to 116 in a couple of hours.
Woohoo! Bye!
Thanks for joining us. See ya.
Bye.
Okay, thanks for bearing with me on that one. It wasn't entirely successful, something to do with the plug and the thing and the thing. Let's have a song. So we're going to need that one. I'm going to need that one. And let's have this one called Nika Libre's At Dusk by Ben Howard. Okay, that was Nika Libres at Dusk by Ben Howard. 3 minutes time, we'll be hopefully having a chat with Alan McElroy about his show tomorrow, which is called Mistaken Identity. And just to get us there while I get the phone call set up, sorry about the Morgana schmozzle. It was a bit of a technical disaster. Something, the plug just wouldn't stay in the phone, and every time I'd unplug, the phone cut the call. Anyway, here's some Kruangbin, one of my favorites by them, Maria Tambien. Okay, that was Maria Tambien by Kruangbin, and I'm joined now by Alan McElroy. You still there, Alan? Okay. I really need some technical assistance with this. Alan, you... Oh, for fuck's sake. Okay. Sorry about the swearing. Let's try it again. Hello, is that Alan? Is that Alan?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Oh, hi, Alan. Sorry about that. I will just sort that out. Okay, so welcome back to Fringe Radio. I'm Damien. I'm talking to Alan McElroy. And unfortunately, Alan's 6 o'clock show tonight had to be cancelled due to work commitments. But you're flying up tomorrow, I understand, Alan.
Yeah, I fly out in the morning, drive up to Whangarei for the show at 4:30, I think it is.
Right. So it's the show's called Mistaken Identity, with the emphasis on taken. Is it a straight example of identity theft, or what's it all? What's going on?
Could be argued that way. My IMDb has been mixed up with an American director's IMDb. So he's written movies like Tekken and Spawn, and also was in Shortland Street for 2 episodes and wrote jokes for 7 days. So during lockdown, I had people thinking I was him, despite me being a pasty ginger,
right,
and him being African-American.
But there was a New Zealand connection with him. There was a New Zealand connection in the sense that he'd been in Shortland Street, did you say?
No, I was in Shortland Street.
Oh, sorry, right. So there's no connection at all with the black...
No, absolutely. Right. I don't even think he knows where this place is.
So
I've just got a load of people that, you know, think I'm him. on Instagram and send me abuse and tell me how bad my movies are. So yeah. During lockdown, I started having fun with them.
Right.
And then I had people send me, relentlessly send me their show reels to try and work on movies that the other Alan is making.
So
I've tried to argue with them and say it's not me, but they didn't believe me. So in the end, I just set them tasks to do, and they sent me weird videos, and I got into audition for stuff that doesn't exist.
So did you just do that to the assholes, or did you do that to everyone?
I did it to whoever would fall for it. I was bored. I was in lockdown, right. So the assholes I had fun with, and then other ones I just said, look, it's not me, and they still sent me show reels and videos, and
right.
So there's one guy who said he could do a Scouse accent and he couldn't, so I asked him to recite Hickory Dickory Dock in a Scouse accent in very intensely, like Hickory Fit, right? So that was him. And then someone else said people call her the female Childish Gambino, so I said, if you put on a fake moustache and can you recite Hickory Dickory Dock and just send me the video. So she sent me that. And then another guy, a French guy, wanted to compose music for my movie that doesn't exist. So I said, can you recite Hickory? Can you give me a French version of Hickory Dickory Dock? And then he was hard to work with, so I fired him. I sacked him from a job that doesn't exist. So then he sent me the music. So there's that, and there's other little things that I've done with other people, right. And silly stories where I've been mistaken for other people. I made a comedy sketch show in university. It was when Colin Farrell was just about to make it big.
Uh-huh.
And he, I don't know if you remember, he released, or a sex tape was released, with him in it at the start of his career. And when he's performing a certain act, he says, this is like breakfast, lunch and dinner all in one down here. So we recreated that, but I was just eating a kebab. That was the joke. And we released it on YouTube, and it went viral. And I thought, I'm going to be famous. But then it turned out it was on my mate told me it was on a gay porn site. I accidentally made a POV, homosexual porno, that went viral on the internet. So there's a load of silly stories of things that have happened over the years, and it's all in this show tomorrow.
See. And do any of these people make it into the show? In kind of, is it just you mostly telling the stories about what happened? Is it straight stand up?
Or videos. Videos of everything.
Oh, yeah. I see. Right. So you are showing videos of these people who sort of relentlessly sent you stuff. And do you think that's what it's like being the other Alan McElroy? Do you think he's constantly?
Yeah. Well, I doubt he's getting lots of people asking to see his stand-up shows, or I doubt he's getting people thinking he's it. But he must get that constantly.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's non-stop. It's another one came in yesterday. Someone wants to do visual effects. On something that it doesn't even exist.
Oh my god!
But they keep on sending the stuff because that's the nature of acting, you know.
Yeah.
So they're just trying to get their names out there.
Yeah.
But they don't believe that I'm not him, despite my face.
and you couldn't be more different, as you say. What did you describe yourself as? A Paisley Ginger.
Paisley Ginger. Yeah.
Oh, Paisley.
I look nothing like him.
Yeah. So, Alan, I was also, while I was getting ready to talk to you, I had a quick look on Spotify at your Bad Gigs podcast and picked on one where you were talking to James, what's his name, the Filipino guy.
Oh, Dave Correos.
Oh, sorry, Dave Correos, yeah. The opening part of the podcast was about you having a gig at the Butter Factory in Whangarei, so where he bombed and got naked after 2 minutes and spent the rest of the 18 minutes standing there naked. Sounds quite amusing. Are you still making that podcast?
I took a break, I've one more to release with Justine Smith from the project. And then I started working on a podcast with an Irish guy called Adam, called Egypt Abroad, where we just share weird stories. He works in a pub in Auckland.
Yeah.
So Egypt Abroad is out. So I have a few episodes of that. And then I'll get back. I just needed a break from, you know, from the bad gigs, but there's a lot more. There's a lot more I have to release that is still on the hard drive.
I mean, I guess every stand-up has probably got one. I've been talking to a few stand-ups, and there are some terrible, you know, where they don't even want to listen to stand-up when you're trying to do a gig. What stands out for you as your absolute worst?
Well, dude, there's a couple of odd ones, but one that Nick Rado actually had a very similar story. I was doing a warm-up for the Red Nose Day in Auckland. So it was like Jeremy Corbett was hosting and Paul Ego.
Yeah.
So whenever they were on the screen, I was dragged off. And then whenever it was a break or they showed a VT, then I was put back out to try and make the people laugh and keep them entertained. But behind me, there was a VT of babies dying and starving children.
Oh, God.
And I'm supposed to make people laugh. And I didn't know that was on the screen behind me.
Oh.
It just got really weird and dark all of a sudden. And then I realized, this is mental. This is absolutely mental. This is not a job.
And they probably thought you were a bit sick, even trying to do that with that going on behind
you. That was it. I just had a director shout at me, get out there and do some stuff. I'm like, there's kids dying on the telly. You know what I mean? What am I supposed to do?
So, God.
That's one of the oddest, the toughest ones I've had.
Right. So how have you ended up out here, Alan?
I met my ex has family here, so I was working on TV in Ireland and she was working in a hospital and Ireland was just hitting a recession.
Uh-huh.
And we just thought, let's get out, let's do a runner.
Right.
And then came out here, so lived here for about 12 years.
Yeah? Is it a good place to be a stand-up? Is there enough work?
Yeah, well, you got to make your own work. You know? So I organise gigs and I put on comedy pub quizzes and stuff. So I create my own work. It is it's not as easy as, say, Australia, where there's a lot more gigs, or Ireland and the UK.
Yeah.
But you can make a living. This is my job.
Yeah.
It's fun.
And do you still get to travel around a lot? Oh, obviously with COVID, but do you still get to do gigs all around the world?
Yeah, well, after once the borders opened, I used to go to Australia a lot and Asia. So now I went back to do the Melbourne Comedy Festival. And that's like, there wasn't that many comedians allowed in. So I'm a citizen here, so I was fine.
Right.
The Irish show at the festival, it's normally about four comedians and I host, but it was just me for an hour. And then even the British show, they had no British comedians. I was hosting it.
Oh.
There was a Greek fella. There was a Canadian fella. You know what I mean? And there was an Aussie guy dressed up as a Scottish character. That's how desperate they were. But
right.
But now I get to travel around. Like, I haven't really travelled around New Zealand in the years that I've lived here.
Right.
And now we've been everywhere. So, like, in Wellington now and Whangarei and Whanganui last weekend. So, yeah, it's cool. I get to go everywhere here.
Yeah. And so what are you looking forward to, in the near future? What have you got lined up?
For work, doing some TV stuff and then just more gigs. And then I go back to Ireland and the UK for a wedding.
Uh-huh.
Bloody wedding. But I'll get the gig over there again for the first time in years. So yeah, just
are you still quite well known in Ireland?
Nah, I wasn't that well known to begin with. It was a kids TV show. it was shown on prime time on a Friday and then Hangover TV on a Sunday morning. it was just a weird show. But yeah, I have a lot of mates in comedy, so I'll just gig with them and do as many gigs as I can, and also enjoy myself.
Yeah, I mean, you're quite portable as a comedian, aren't you? You don't have a lot of gear or overheads, so that's cool. Well, who do you like in terms of New Zealand comedy, Alan? Who are your favourites?
New Zealand, I love they're my mates, but Lovegrove, Brendan Lovegrove is one of the ones, and Nick Rado as well, and Dave Correa.
Yeah.
The people that I've done the podcast with, really.
Yeah.
And Justine Smith is one of my favourites. But yeah, there's a good few. But I think Lovegrove, I think he's up there now.
Brendan's
there now. Yeah, he's one of the best live acts you'll ever see.
What is it about him? Because I heard the phrase insult comedy earlier this week. Another comedian was describing it, and my memory of seeing him at the Butter Factory was that he's quite ferocious.
Yeah, it's not. He doesn't insult. He's on the line. and that's what makes it dangerously funny.
Yeah.
He's not as, he doesn't say the stuff he used to say on stage because you can't nowadays.
Yeah.
But he's one that, whether it's, we've done a gig where there were 7 people and he just had them straight away, or 100, 200 people and he just has them straight away. He's charismatic. Don't tell him I said this, actually. I shouldn't pay him any more compliments. He's funny. I'll just leave it at that. He's funny. Yeah.
I think when I saw him at the Butter Factory, a family got up and walked out. And I thought that was quite that was quite surprising, because you know you would expect if you go to stand up you're going to be, I mean, I think that's what we pay comedians for, don't you reckon, to go there?
Yeah, I think so, but there's a different attitude toward comedy at the moment with, to say, woke comedy or whatever.
Yeah.
Where you're not allowed to make jokes about certain subjects, and the subjects you should never make jokes about, but you should be able to still be a bit dangerous, you know. That's where the funny is. So, yeah, if someone walked out with a family, why would you? You know, he's over 18, so
yeah,
they
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
And he's famous. He's been on TV. They know what he's like.
Yeah. What about some other sort of more well-known comedians who, you know, in terms of the kind of the comedy greats? Who would you say you like?
Tommy Kiernan, Irish comedian, Billy Connolly, Peter Kay, all of those sort of, the ones that tell stories, that's what I like to do, so they're big influences.
Yeah, and do you watch a lot? Like, do you sort of, is that your sort of, you know, go-to for recreational viewing?
Nah, not anymore. We used to joke that Billy Connolly basically babysat us. Like, my dad left the videos on constantly when we were kids.
Right.
Like, we were swearing in school because that's what we thought you did. But I don't really watch it anymore. I don't know why. Every now and again, I'll probably watch Peter Kay just because it's so silly.
Yeah.
But you'd be afraid in case you end up copying it.
Yeah, I can understand. You know? Yeah. When did you kind of realize or decide that you were funny? Like, when was that moment?
I was in school, I didn't want to be the center of attention, but every now and again you accidentally were.
Yeah.
And then I have a face that got me in trouble. So a teacher would say, you're up to something, you have a weird smile. And I didn't. I was just daydreaming. So when you get in trouble, you might as well be in trouble. So we just started having fun and making people laugh. And then college as well. And we got kicked out of college, a few of us, it was Dublin, we were 17, 18.
Yeah.
And then that was it, and then someone put my name down. I was interviewing comedians for a project, and I was making them laugh, and they were saying, you should give this a go, but I didn't have the balls at the time, and then somebody put my name down for a competition, and I have to do it, I did it, and I won that thing, that show on the night.
Right.
And then I loved it. I had a panic attack on stage, but that was besides the point.
Has that ever happened again?
No, but I tried to recreate it because it's like if you wear your lucky underpants.
Yeah.
So I did a gig, it went really well, panic attack, they thought it was part of the act. So for about 4 or 5 years, I was having 4 cans of Red Bull before going on stage to try and recreate that manic, sort of dangerous, painful anxiety.
Yeah.
And then, I think it was when my daughter was born, my attitude changed and I thought, I don't need all of that. Just get up and talk.
Yeah.
And it's fine. But yeah, it was that's pretty much the start of it. It was me nearly collapsing on stage.
I think you said on one of the podcasts, when you bomb, you go back to your original material. Is that right? If it's going badly, you'll kind of dredge from your subconscious that early material.
Yeah, it's hard to explain that, but yeah, if they're a tough crowd, then you'll end up, it's like that's stuck in your head, your earliest stuff, and you'll go back to that. Yeah. But that's what I used to do. I'm different now. I talk to them more, and I just, if they're a tough crowd, then you kind of have to, because I was just talking to comedians today about it. Like, when I first came here, and I was doing warm-up for TV, the directors told us, you have to tell the audience, if you find something funny, let your mouth open and laugh. Like, it's a different type of audience here because comedy was late coming to New Zealand.
Yeah.
You know, so the audiences didn't know. how to be an audience. So sometimes you're pretty much explaining, just open your arms. If you find a funny laugh, don't worry about it. Laugh. It's natural.
Yeah.
And so that's it. So if the crowd are a bit like that, if I go to do a gig in a town where no one visits, then that's, you kind of explain it and you break it down and then you get back into it.
Right,
so
sort of
change my approach.
Educate them how to be an audience and then get on with it.
So you're not watching Netflix, you know what I mean? Yeah. You're not at home in lockdown watching Netflix.
Yeah.
We're here. Laughter's infectious. And then it's easy after that.
And where's the most obscure place you've played in New Zealand, Alan?
Oh, everywhere. Well, Whanganui was an odd one last weekend.
Oh, yeah?
Where there was a great crowd, but there was about four people who I didn't know at the time refused to pay in. And they had this attitude that they could heckle. So as soon as the MC went on stage, this guy stood up and started screaming random stuff.
Yeah.
So we had to kick him out, like literally kick him out.
Oh, yeah.
Of the gig. Yeah. It was mental. But he didn't understand. That's what he thought comedy was. You know, he thought that's what you do. You come and you heckle.
Yeah. So we've been talking to some of the other stand-ups about heckling, and one of them explained to me that, you know, your job as the comedian is to make sure that everyone has a good time, and so you've got to kind of manage that. And is the heckling sort of, what's the word, milder here than in other places, or how would you describe it?
I'd say it's milder in general.
Yeah.
But I haven't really been heckled. I've been heckled in Australia because one, they thought I was a Kiwi.
What?
Because New Zealand comedy, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So on my poster. So I turned up and he just goes, he started making sheep noises before I even opened my mouth. And then he goes, and then I just talked, are you okay? And
yeah.
He said, oh, you're not a Kiwi, you're a Paddy. It's just old man.
Yeah.
But I don't mind heckles. I ripped into them. Videos I've shared on Instagram. Like two nights ago, or last weekend in New Plymouth, a woman said something. I can't remember what she said, but I asked her, is she okay? She said something weird. And I said, what's your name? What do you do? And she said, I'm a cleaner. And then she said, commercial cleaner. And I started laughing, going, it doesn't matter if you're cleaning shit in the McDonald's or cleaning shit in a hotel. You're still cleaning shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Commercial cleaner. So there's always... there's always something to play with people. So I kind of encourage them to have a chat.
Yeah.
And because it's exciting for me. I don't know where we're going to go.
Right. And you can handle that kind of excitement.
Cause, I love it. Love it. It's because you get bored, you know.
Yeah. And we had a gig at the comedy club here at the Fringe After Dark, and there was a heckler, and he eventually was so drunk that he got up and left. But there was almost a sense of when he'd gone, the comedians were like, now what do we do? Because everyone else was quite passive. Have you ever done those sort of, have you ever done, because that was at the Dice show, have you ever done kind of improvisational comedy?
Pretty much all of what I do is improv. I've done a show a few years ago in Australia called Winging It, where I just made up the whole show.
God.
From the audience. I did about four. It was one night was tough. That was the night with the old guy thinking I was a Kiwi. But then that brought that show in a different direction than it possibly would have gone.
Right.
So yeah, because I MC a lot.
Yeah.
At the comedy club. It's a lot of banter, a lot of improv, and that's it. And if the crowd are up for it, then it can be one of the greatest nights. And if they're not, they just want to hear stories, then you just tell stories.
Yeah, I see. So you sounds like you get quite good at reading the crowd and sort of sussing out what the right approach is going to be.
Yeah, and what you can say to certain people, and you can say stuff. I was talking to a guy yesterday, and he was at a gig, and he said, I asked a woman what dog she had, and she said a Rottweiler. And I said, if a Rottweiler, you mad bitch. And he said, how did you get away with saying that?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, because you kind of read her, you know, I knew she was crying laughing, she was wiping away tears.
Yeah.
So she's already in that place where she's having a great time, and she gets it, and she came to see us.
Yeah.
An Irish and Scottish comedy night. So
right.
It's there's a lot of, you're always reading the room to see what they're like, and who you should talk to and who you shouldn't talk to.
Mm.
So yeah, it keeps you on your toes. Like that's the exciting part.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds great. All right, Alan, I think we better wrap it up there. Thanks so much for joining us, and we look forward to your show. So it's tomorrow night here in Whangarei at the Fringe After Dark Club.
Yep.
And sorry, it's 4 p.m. We've also got the Dice Show after you, and then Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers have got a set.
Yep.
And then the Fringe Comedy Finale, so I guess you'll be involved in that too.
Yeah, I think I'm doing a set there as well.
Awesome. Okay. Look forward to it, and it's been great talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
No worries. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the call.
All right, mate. See ya.
Cheers. All the best.
Bye. Okay. That was... hopefully you could hear that all right. Maybe a little bit not great quality, but it's the best we can do here at Beagle Radio. That was Alan McElroy, comedian. I've really enjoyed talking to comedians, actually, on Fringe Radio. I guess it's their job to be charming and interesting and go with the flow. So that's cool. And so there's a bit of a comedy climax tomorrow with... Alan, and then the Dice Show. So Stephen Lyons is back with the Dice Show. The sort of started and finishing the Fringe. He did a set on Friday the 30th, and then we've got the Awkward Indian Guy Act. And I'm speaking to Advait tomorrow on Fringe Radio. I talked about him a bit earlier. Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers, and then the Fringe Comedy Finale. I guess you say finale at 8:30 p.m. So, I should say, we've got Anthony Crum, a.k.a. Crum, who has morphed into a comedian, a stand-up comedian. Well, I guess he was always a bit of a clown, but he's now a stand-up comedian, among other things, and he's performing at 10 o'clock tomorrow night. And I'm hoping to have a chat with him on Fringe Radio tomorrow. He's a Whangarei boy, so I think he's probably even been in Beagle Radio before doing stuff. So that's going to be cool. That's the end of our guests for today. So I'm going to chuck a record on. And this one is The Magician by Andy Schauf. Thank you.
Welcome back to Fringe Radio, the last 20 minutes of today's show. Had two interesting phone conversations with Morgana O'Reilly, who was on her way up to Auckland, and she'll be arriving here at 116 shortly, and Alan McElroy about his adventures borrowing or stealing the other Alan McElroy's identity and setting people who sent him basically requests for work, sending them silly tasks, and they went ahead and did them and believed that they were doing it for the other Alan B. McElroy, who's apparently some big American producer and writer of films like Venom and things like that.
Okay, never heard of him.
No, nor have I. And he said he's sure that the black American Alan McElroy doesn't get requests for comedy gigs. people mistaking the Irish pasty ginger, as he described himself. Anyway, that was good. Good to chat with him. And I've got Matt with me in the studio. He's come in to do a bit of a review of what he saw yesterday, because that's always good to hear someone else's take on it. So what did you see, Matt, yesterday?
Well, I started out halfway through the day down in Cameron Street Mall and saw the what's the name of the buskers?
Buskers
on the Road. Yeah. Which was really cool. It was fun. Great. They had a huge crowd. Yeah. And the hat was nicely full at the end of it. Lots of notes in there. So, and that's a big part of the routine. They're telling you this is their full-time job and they've put in a lot of work, but it did it in a really comfortable way, but just very funny, cool tricks, lots of fire and juggling and balancing. And
so they were inside, were they in the bit with the white canopy over the trees? Were they in that bit?
Just to the side of that. In that space there by the big tree, So, and it was a lovely day and, smart timing, kind of midday, everybody's hopping around for lunch. And just the way that that they work the crowd is really cool to watch and very funny.
Yeah. It's nice to have street stuff, isn't
it? It is. It's so easy, you know, and people just get pulled into it. And it's a really, it's all that stuff you want to see, like people bumping into each other and just kind of sharing something interesting and cool. So, yeah.
And probably caught some people who possibly aren't even aware that the Fringe Festival's
going on. I imagine a lot of people had, and they weren't necessarily talking. They did kind of plug that they've got a cabaret show here at 116. They had one last night. They got another, a late night one tonight starting at 10. But they plugged that a bit. But there was no, there was no big push for Fringe. But, was definitely part of a festival like that. It was very fringy.
Cool. So they were, that was their, they did their comedy cabaret at night here. And they were saying when they came in yesterday to the studio, they were hoping to attract some local talent. I don't know if they did, but I wasn't here for that. What else did you see after their street show?
Then went to, I kind of mucked around the rest of the day, but then went down to Patahi Park for the Fringe the City event sponsored by North Power, which was, it's the first time I've seen the park with the amphitheatre full. It was absolutely chocker. There were people everywhere and it was a lovely evening. It was a beautiful evening actually, and there were musicians. Beagle Radio was down there. Chris Foote had organised the DJs to have tunes in the background, and Circus Kumarani had set up a kind of fenced off or roped off place for kids, and there was just heaps of circus stuff for kids to hang out with. And then there were mainly kind of a revolving crew of fire. What do you call fire?
Fire jugglers.
Fire breathers. Yeah, all that sort of stuff. Sticks and there was a bullwhip that was on fire, which was very dramatic. And one of the woman's pants caught fire briefly, which was exciting. And
is that Circus Kumarani putting that?
I don't think it was. I think it's like this troupe of pyromaniacs, basically, who were just, they were cool. They were so cool to watch. And then as it kind of got darker, you know, just that the effect of the fire is just is quite mesmerizing. It's quite beautiful. Yeah. So that went on for a good 3 hours. Heaps and heaps of happy people, heaps of families. And Haley was making badges and kind of windmills and stuff for kids. So
great.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was really great.
That and Hearty and Me Hearties have been to the two kind of big outdoor events for Fringe.
They have, and it was a shame. You kind of got an idea what Hearty and Me Hearties would have been like if the weather had behaved, because people wanted to come out, and it amazed me the number of people that were there. It was,
And isn't it great that that ugly old car park that used to be there is now
it's turned into park. Yeah, into this amazing community resource that and it is cool. I mean, they've done a really good job of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, oh, it really felt like the heart of the city last night.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Okay, so were you there for the whole thing? Like, did you?
Yeah, well, I think we got there. It was advertised to start at 6:30, actually, so that's when I get there. But apparently, it started quite a bit earlier at 5:30. So,
right. Well, it's so nice to be outside again.
Yeah.
Spring. Yeah, I was at Man Lessons last night, so I missed the Putahi Park thing, and yeah, Man Lessons was really interesting. Talking to Morgana O'Reilly, who's coming up to do her Stories About My Body, similar sort of director audience, very personal.
Yeah.
I don't think confessional's the right word. It's not really a confessional. It's just more like a telling of your personal experience. And there's something really intriguing about that. And Morgana's talking about sort of her life story through the medium of her body.
Which is incredibly brave.
Yeah, very brave. I asked her if she found it terrifying. And she said, no, I used the word liberating. And she said, yeah, it's more of a high, you know.
Right.
She's had moments where she looks in the mirror and goes, why are you doing this? But it's totally, she said the reaction she gets from, you know, from women particularly, she said predominantly it's women at the show, but she thinks that's just because women generally get out and buy tickets more to that kind of event. But she said she has some great, you know, it's very affirming. It's very kind of body affirming and body positive. So yeah, Man Lessons, it's a sort of autobiography. Well, it's the last 7 years of Adam's life as he's transitioned, and supported by video of taken by Ben, who's the documentary filmmaker who's working with Adam. And yeah, it was really, really interesting and powerful insight into that and process. And Adam's parents and ex-partner were also there at the show. And it kind of struck me that probably for some trans people, they don't have that kind of support, unconditional love and support, and how difficult it was having that support still was a difficult thing. So I guess that's the hard time for someone who's trans to not have people around you, strong sort of support. Okay, so where did you head after the Putahi Park?
So I went down to Wham, to Climate Imaginaries, which started at 8:30, and it wasn't in the museum itself. It was in the little, so you go in the doors and turn right, it's like a little waiting area.
Yeah.
So
why do you think they chose that?
Well, the only thing I could think of was that maybe they weren't expecting many people. And I got there right at the, or just before it started, literally a couple of minutes before it started, 8:30, and it was chocker. There were people spilling out the door, which, you know, for people who couldn't get right into the main area, you were definitely restricted in what you could see. So they were projecting up onto the roof and onto the sides of, you know, the side walls. And so if you weren't in the actual room itself, which is a small room, I don't know, it would be kind of maybe 5 meters by 4 meters or something. Like it feels like it's small. If you weren't in there, you definitely missed out.
So Kim Newell was looking after the visuals.
Kim was doing the visuals, and Matt DeBoer, who we talked to at the start of last week, was doing the looping and the, I don't know what you call it, the song cycle kind of. There were nine movements or nine parts to the to the piece, and each stage moved through a different part of the climate crisis, the one that we're in now, and you know what's going to come, and so we, you know, we got a sheet of paper at the start explaining what was happening, and you could identify what stage you were in by the instrument that Matt was playing. And so he was, you know, he started off with a flute, and then it was a clarinet, and then he also played guitar, a couple of different types of flutes. There was a bamboo flute and a saxophone, and also the Irish drum, which actually was my favourite one. It sounded quite beautiful, and he would just loop little samples over and over, and then add different music instruments on top of it, and you could feel this building sense of almost not quite dread, but it became more and more ominous as you know, as the impending crisis built. So, and then Kim was just using quite natural, or literally natural materials to do his projection. So he's working with his very powerful relatively powerful digital microscopes, and he would put like blossoms or plant material under them, and then magnify them, and then project them, and then turn them around. And so there are these, you know, these things that you wouldn't see any other way, highly detailed and beautiful colours, all kind of on the walls and the roof. And it was, I thought it was stunning. And the only comment that was slightly negative would be it needed to be in a bigger space.
Yeah.
So shame. I was thinking it would be perfect here at 116.
Right. Yeah, it's a shame they didn't have, maybe didn't have access, or maybe, as you say, didn't expect.
Yeah.
Or I wondered if the windows was part of, were they hoping that,
I don't know. And talking to Matt, I said, oh, that's quite a late start. And he said, yeah, it has to be 8:30 for it to be, because the space isn't dark otherwise. And I'm thinking, in here with the blacked out room, you could have it earlier. Because it's definitely something kids could enjoy. And there were people just lying down on the floor when there was a bit more space, just eyes closed and kind of absorbing it, and then periodically opening to look at the images and the video. But yeah, a bigger space would be better.
And how long did it run for?
It was an hour and a half. I think I stayed for about just under an hour, 50 minutes or something. And it was fine. It was one of those things where you could walk in and out of your. I think it would be better to be at the start and stay rather than kind of drop in halfway through. But it stands as a. You mean, I was talking to Maggie Buxton at the end, and she described it as performance art, and that was part of the reason she said why they wanted it at the museum, because it felt like a better fit. But I felt it would work as a musical event that had amazing visuals with it. So,
and so the kind of organizing idea is that these are cycles that we're going in, and that there is a regenerative part to a cycle. There's a destructive part to a cycle.
Yep.
So it felt hopeful, didn't feel too doom and gloom?
No, it didn't to me. And I like Matt's description of it. He said, you know, we're not trying to tell you how it's going to be or how you should respond. He said, it's more about us trying to put you in a state of mind where you become contemplative and reflective, and you do the work yourself. But, you know, this is where we're trying to put you, in a space where you can do that, which I like too. It's not, you know, punching you over the head with something. It's trying to gently lead you towards something.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds fascinating. And I'm glad they had an audience. And we were talking off air just earlier and sort of suggesting that maybe, you know, people have got the idea about Fringe I was thinking it's a bit like living in Wellington for 2 weeks, isn't it? You're oversupplied.
You are. There's something happening, you know, every day, most hours of the day, and often there are overlapping things, and you have to make choices about what you can and can't see.
Yeah, and yesterday was a particularly, I think yesterday, in terms of number, was the most things that are on, but today's also pretty full on. And did you make it to Bury a Ninja at all?
No, I'm going to Bury a Ninja tonight at, I think it's 5:30, is it? Everybody I've spoken to has said it's amazing.
It's really fascinating to watch, particularly such a skilled performer as Julie, you know, being those characters and setting them up with very minimal sort of physical gestures and voice and things like that, and she could just switch instantly between them, and you could follow that person's sort of narrative, even though it was chopped up. And it's funny, and it's almost uncanny watching such a skilled performer. It's kind of mimicry. I mean, they make a virtue of mimicking exact, not mimicking because that sounds like they're taking the piss, which they're not, but like replicating what that person's body language and gesture and, you know, intonation and the way they talk. And I can see why it's more powerful than lecturing, say, health professionals on how to work with Māori in the system, hearing those people's actual voices and realizing actually what I took away from it was it's really easy. All you have to do is be curious. All you have to do is be respectful, and all you have to do is ask people what they want, rather than just assuming that you know what they want. But I also was aware, you know, and this show doesn't blame health professionals at all, but they're working in a very stretched system, aren't they?
So
to build an extra capacity to be kind and caring and patient and inclusive and culturally sensitive and all the things that the show's raising, I think, especially because, you know, the nurses at the moment are really under the pump, and you can imagine saying to them, well, in addition to this, can you also, you know, it's got to be sort of a systemic change rather than just an attitude shift among the...
Well, it does, but I think that's a big part of, you know, the Māori health provider, and that's what that's trying to address, is that accepting that there are inequities in the system, and the system does not work for everybody, and so you have to. And I get, well, it's not a politics show, but I get so frustrated and despondent when you hear the ACT Party come out and say we want a referendum on co-governance, because essentially it's saying we're all the same, and it's just wrong.
Yeah,
it's absolutely wrong. And and you know, unless, and it's a social investment issue. You know, if we do not address the issue of inequity, and for say Māori and Pacific to address those problems, then we're going to have long term health problems that, you know, everybody's got to pay for. So sorted at the start.
And I sort of was also thinking while I was watching Barry Ninja, and I remember this from working in schools. There was the bottom line was what's good for Māori is good for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, you know, it's a two tier system or they're getting preferential treatment, and you know, it's being more inclusive and more culturally competent and all those sorts of things is good for everyone. It just makes a kinder system.
That is this kind of ludicrous Puritan waspish attitude that everybody has to be equal, and you know, doesn't take into account inequity that is entirely out of some people's control.
Okay, so that was so that's what you're looking forward to today. Did you go home after the Climate Imaginaries last night?
I just had a brief stop in just to roost, just to catch up with some of the fringe people, and that was a nice little wind down. But I had a chat to Maggie Coco and also to Josh Kiwi, who performed at the Octagon Theatre last night in Maggie's Song Cycles, and Josh was painting live, and the audience were coming up and adding to the painting, and Maggie was performing this 1 hour song cycle, and apparently it was stunning, absolutely stunning. Everybody I talked to loved it. So.
I found talking to Maggie on Wednesday really fascinating. Quite, she's got no idea how it's going to go.
Yeah.
And I said, do the audience come up on stage? And she said, I don't really know.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of unknowns about it. And I guess the Octagon was a good venue for that. Nice and small and nice wide stage. And,
yep. No, I think it was perfect.
And she said she's acquired this quite significant collection of art now.
Yeah.
From, you know, I said, well, what are you going to do with it? And she said, I don't know really. We're, you know, I'm sure there's an exhibition or something.
Well, that's what I asked them last night. And, and her husband, Mickey, said, yeah, they were looking at an exhibition that, you know, they'd be able to show everything in one place. So,
great. Yeah. Do you know who she's got tonight for the art?
No, I don't.
Olivia Gurelja is out of action, I think.
So, oh, okay.
I guess that will become clear at some point. So Maggie's show is on again tonight at 8 p.m. And it's $30 or pay what you can. So Maggie's... says that $30 is what she needs in order to, you know, pay her way to make it viable for her. But she also doesn't want to exclude people. So I thought that's a great way to set it up. And so, yeah, Barry Ninja's at 5:30. And then I haven't caught Ready Set yet, but they're playing their second of three gigs tonight.
Ah, okay.
And it's only a 45-minute show. I might try and...
Whereabouts is that?
That's at Whangarei Girls High.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no,
yep. And it's Koha as well. And then...
What time does that start?
That's 5:30 p.m.
5:30 as well.
Yeah, okay. Same time as Barry Ninja.
Yep.
Then at 6:30 p.m. we've got the Awkward Indian Guy, ACT. And he's a stand-up comedian from South Asia with autism. And I was saying on the radio this morning, my experience of people with autism is that they can often... They've got a prodigious memory for jokes. I used to know this kid, a kid who's autistic, and he could just bang them out. I was like, I'll be interested to see what his... he's coming in on the show tomorrow to have a chat as well, which will be great. If you want to catch Man Lessons, the live show, it's on again tonight at 7. Brendan Lovegrove's second gig at Fringe After Dark at 7:30 p.m. I'm guessing he probably sells pretty well, so he doesn't probably need much promotion.
Yeah, I think he's fine.
Yep. And then Morgana's Stories About My Body here at 116. I'd strongly recommend it. I saw it when it was on at Q, and it's just, she's a great performer. It's funny. It's personal. It's quite out there, but, you know, and she's quite upfront about that. There will be full nudity and you will love it, you know, and what's not to like about that? and then Ray O'Leary. Are you familiar with Ray O'Leary?
No.
Okay, so he's this sort of odd-looking guy. He's coming in tomorrow as well, big with a big, great, big curly mop of hair, and he's very sort of deadpan delivery, sort of droll. I don't know what the word is, but almost seems a bit sort of
simple. You know, he's deliberately, willfully being quite slow, and he's quite well known. I think he's quite a well known comedian. And Becky Umbers, and there aren't many female comedians.
No,
we've hardly seen any. We had
Pat Goldsack,
aka Katie Boyle. And other than that, I don't think there have.
No, there are a few in the Dice Show, and also in the open mic night. But not many with their own show.
No,
we were talking about that actually. That seems to be a bit of a preserve of young dudes and how off key they can sometimes be.
They sure can. Yeah, I think probably comedy audiences are quite forgiving as well. Maybe
sometimes.
Not, they're not all, you know, there's less of a tendency to. And I think in the moment sometimes we laugh. In spite of ourselves.
And we're encouraging them.
Yeah.
Someone should be telling them to go home and talk to the mothers.
Yeah. So finishing up tonight, I think it's the latest show that's there's been in the Fringe at 10 o'clock. Buskers on the Road, their comedy cabaret, kicks off after Stories About My Body here at 116. And that's an hour and a half show, so it'll be a late bedtime. But it is Friday night. So what a great way to finish up the Fringe. And then tomorrow there's a huge comedy lineup. Starting with Mistaken Identity at 4, The Dice Show at 5:30, Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers at 7, The Fringe Comedy Finale at 8:30, and then our very own Anthony Crum is on at 10 p.m.
Yes,
comedian, fresh from Austin, Texas. Who knew that there's a comedy scene in Austin, Texas? Yep. But I think it's one of the more liberal Texan towns, isn't it, Austin?
Yeah.
So he might have an American accent, and he might have some good material about America.
He may do.
And he's hopefully going to come in for a chat on the radio, because he is, after all, Fangaday born and bred.
And he owes us.
We gave you your first break, Crumb. Don't forget it. It's been great and so enjoyable watching him and that whole kind of cohort evolve, and having Summer back here last week was great. And they're just, you know, they're 10 years into their careers, and they're all going in different and interesting directions. Okay, well, that's Fringe Radio for today. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll be back tomorrow. I've got a good lineup of guests. If you can just bear with me while I log back in, I'll tell you quickly who they are. We have got Advait coming in at 9, Stephen Lyons at 10, Ray O'Leary and Becky Umber at 10:30, and Harley Alexander from Blackadder at 11:30. See you then.